welcome back to another episode of the TetraCast. This is RPG Site's weekly podcast where we get the site staff together to talk about our favorite genre of video games. We've got the usual crew here today. I'm your host. My name is Brian Vitale. Joining me, as always, we have Josh Torres.
The last podcast in the pre-Inazuma 11 Victory Road era, before Inazuma 11 time.
Mikhail Madnani.
Hello.
Adam Vitale.
How do I respond to that?
Just like that. James Galizio.
Man, so many 100-hour RPGs releasing this year.
And Chumman Wu.
I just beat one in 15 hours.
All right. I'm looking forward to see what Zhao has to talk about. Short RPGs. We champion short RPGs. But yeah, we're a week into November. We are wrapping up the, or getting close to wrapping up a lot of the big releases of the year. We have, you know, November is probably not as exciting of a month as October in terms of like sheer quantity of releases, but there's still a lot of big games to talk about. And we're going to be talking about one this week. It's kind of in the fringe of the RPG space, but it's a series that we've covered in the past. And this is a game that reception seems to be pretty positive on it. So we're going to lead off this podcast with discussion of Hyrule Warriors: Age of Imprisonment. Of course, the third and kind of like the Hyrule Warriors side spin series, the Muzo games, this one taking place, of course, within context to Tears of the Kingdom. We'll talk about it. And then as our second game today, a game that we've wanted to talk about, but we didn't have early access code, an October release. I'll talk a little bit of Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines 2. It's been a kind of a curiosity all year about this game, so I'll kind of give you my thoughts on that. I will talk about a few other releases. Eruta, the baking action RPG side-scrolling game release. Chow just finished that. We'll talk about that. So we're gonna go through those three. And then not a lot of news in terms of like announcements, but some news in terms of like game business. So we'll go into that in the second half of this podcast. Of course, you can look at the timestamps to see where all the discussions are. But without further ado, we will start out with Hyrule Warriors: Age of Imprisonment. We have a few people on the podcast that have played it to some extent. I'm going to start out with Josh, who I know has played at least the opening parts of it, and you've also have experience with the other Hyrule Warriors games, so maybe you'll be able to do a point of comparison. And I think James and Mikhail have also played it to some extent. So we'll kind of just round robin between the few people that have played Hyrule Warriors to start out the discussion. So I'll give it to Josh to start out.
Yeah, so Hyrule Warriors: Age of Imprisonment, I didn't get an early code or anything. I saw the buzz around it, and it wasn't really on my radar, even when it was announced enough to release. And I was like I don't know. I like the Hyrule Warriors series, but they're okay to me because I played other Musou games, and you know, I play a lot of the mainline and spin-offs. And the Hyrule Warriors is like, it's a cool crossover Musou take on the series, and especially the first one had like all the basically pulling from, you know, numerous Zelda games, while Age of Calamity was very Breath of the Wild focused and had like that weird, you know, is it canon, is it not canon? Then you play it, it's like, not really relevant to the overall scope. So one of the weird marketing...
Kind of feel like, sorry, it does kind of feel like, oh, it's another one of these. That's my mindset, not having played it. So I'm going to give it back to you. But yeah. Just like, is this just another one of these? Or like, how does this one stand out from the rest? Or does it even?
So like the weird marketing thing up for this release, that one of their key points, like, oh, the story in this is canon, because they're trying to address the feedback from Age of Calamity, right? Or like that, you know, didn't really shake out the way that you wanted to in terms of how it related to Breath of the Wild. And this one is trying to flesh out a story that was largely in the background of Tears of the Kingdom, but they want to emphasize that it's canon because at the beginning of Tears of the Kingdom, as it goes over at the very beginning of Age of Imprisonment as well, if you didn't play that one, is Link and Zelda unearth this like mysterious ruin, and Link basically gets kind of fucked up by the discovery of, like, I think his arm gets like replaced, or he gets something fucks up his arm, and he gets like a corrupted blade and whatnot, and gets separated from Zelda after that opening sequence of Tears of the Kingdom, where Zelda gets transferred into the far past during the age of like the first ruler of Hyrule, King Rauru and Queen, I already forgot the queen's name. So,
I don't remember her name either.
And So it's trying to flesh out that story of the narrative that was happening in the background while you were kind of just exploring that world again with Ling, except everything's kind of obviously shifted up from Breath of the Wild, where there's like floating islands and a whole underground depth section. You're messing around with the do-it-yourself build, all these constructs, and getting all the Zonai powers, getting the Ultra Hand, and so forth, and messing around with that stuff. And the narrative things in Tears of the Kingdom was like, hey, you want to go to these regions, and you'll unearth like flashbacks of the past, and you'll see, you know, what Zelda is briefly up to in these flashbacks, and then it leads to like a very formulaic frame of storyline where you eventually, you know, solve these regions' problems with like the creature or the enemy that's kind of lingering among them, and then you, after you're done with that, you go off to the next section, etc. So Age of Imprisonment is in this kind of weird, trying to fill this awkward narrative hole in a framework where Tears of the Kingdom, where people generally like the gameplay, but I think the common consensus about Tears of the Kingdom's storyline is it's kind of its weakest part because it's so in the background, it's there, it exists, it gives you an excuse to mingle with the systems of Tears of the Kingdom, but the story of it was never like your motivation to play it. It was always like, hey, that do-it-yourself, cool, like, hey, build shit up, and you're limited by various, you know, resources like battery and so forth. So Age of Imprisonment is, at the moment, about 4 or 5 hours in, and while I'm still not, like, a super attached to the storyline, because Tears of the Kingdom was, narrative-wise, was so kind of eh, it does a good job trying to be earnest about, like, hey, this is what happens with Zelda during that. You meet all these characters that you saw, some you briefly, very briefly saw in Tears of the Kingdom, and others, like, all brand new. Like, you know, there's this new character named Kalamo, which is, like, this Korok, talking Korok seed dude who discovers this mysterious construct that, you know, vaguely is shaped like Link, but, you know, not necessarily Link. And then you meet, like, you know, of course, you get to see more screen time of Raoru. You meet his sister, Mineru, who's, like, kind of a scientist researcher during that whole time. And then you have, like, some of the more foot soldiers, like Typhon and kind of like the battlefield guards that are named. And you also have some of the more significant characters from the other tribes, like RD from the Gerudo, Agraston from the I forgot the gnome.
I'm pretty sure they're all are they unnamed in Tears of the Kingdom? And I'm pretty sure Age of Calamity is the first time they have names.
Well, Age of,
I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, they are named now. I do.
Or Age of Imprisonment. I mean, sorry.
I do love Rafika, the Rito that has the most fabulous hairstyle I've ever seen on a bird.
I haven't met him yet, but the character design does look pretty cool. So, I think it's a pretty awesome game in terms of like how it's structured and of course its performance. So we'll kind of go through those. But the way it's structured is at the very like first maybe hour to have its very story cutscene focus heavy because it's trying to get everyone on the same page of like, hey, here's what's happening at like, here's how Zelda was transported to the past. And kind of doing the building blocks of like trying to introduce these characters in that very first Kingdom of Hyrule and where Zelda fits in there. At first, the enemy variety is very limited because it's about shades and there's not none of the iconic Zelda enemies yet. But then they start introducing Ganondorf fairly early into the picture because of, you know, Hyrule was on fairly good terms with all these other tribes except with the Gerudo, and Gerudo, you know, is now led by Ganondorf, and it starts going through the pace of like, hey, facetiously, Ganondorf is trying to be on good terms with Hyrule to get what he wants. So at a certain point of the story, I won't spoil exactly what happens, but, you know, based on what you've previously seen in Tears of the Kingdom,
that moment happens very early.
Yeah, exactly. And And so the Blood Moon arises based on like what happens with Ganondorf, and then you have all the iconic, like, you know, the Moblins, Bokoblins, the Lazaphos, and all those other creatures all sprawling up through the land. So the very early hours of like, hey, you are met with this like map screen where you're taking on quests. Some of them is just like turning in materials to like get a new attack string or enhance a new attack string on your playable characters, or getting them a heart, or building up a facility to upgrade your weapons and so forth. That map screen drastically changes fairly early on when this Blood Moon arises, and it becomes it transforms it. It becomes all red and becomes this territory control of like, hey, before you can take on quests again, you have to liberate this area from the menace caused by the Blood Moon. So what feels like fairly a low stakes game early on, a very blue skies, very clear, you know, nice weather conditions, all of a sudden it turns red, it's all corrupted, and you're on your back foot because Ganondorf has now seized control of Hyrule Castle and is pretty much wrecking the land and so forth. So you have these different characters and these different elements, different sides of the conflict all come together to try to push forth and make a united front against this common enemy now. And I think the most, the thing that has caught everyone off guard, myself included, is the whole other side of the story where at first you're Zelda with Rauru and the Hyrule Kingdom, but the other side of the story early on is this weird, this mysterious pact between Kalamo and the mysterious construct where they're, of course, the mysterious construct especially is like, it's a very enigmatic character. You don't know exactly, you know, what they're going to do with this character and this relationship between Kalamo and the mysterious construct. But you see early on that this mysterious construct, who is shaped like Link, who you can play, and is definitely powerful, can also shapeshift into like this fighter jet mode. Yeah, fighter like bird jet mode thing. And you're like, that's really cool. So you see that in a scene, and then you're like, I wonder if they're going to do anything with this. And then at a certain point after that Blood Moon thing, you actually get to play that mode of it like being this bird jet form with Kalamo on its back. And it is sort of like a Star Fox level where you have like a basic laser and you get upgrades to start locking onto enemies with a rocket. And then throughout the stage, you are powering them up so you can lock onto more enemies, improve your laser so it becomes a multi-shot. And you're like, fuck, man, this is like a Star Fox light stage. Like, it is definitely pulling from that series, especially with like the dodge rolls and perfect dodge rolling to reflect back projectiles. And you're like, this is insane. And this is all running both the on battlefield and that Star Fox segment in a pretty smooth 60 FPS. It's not always 60 FPS, like, for example, like the scenes are like 30 FPS cap, and like maybe some of like the in-game out of combat segments are maybe not hitting that target, but it really does feel smooth and responsive. Like, really,
the way I describe it is that it's a locked 60 FPS when it matters, and when the frame rate drops, usually it's because you did something cool.
yeah, exactly. You're right. Yeah, and it carries over a lot of those elements from the Hyrule Warriors series where enemies attack, and sometimes you'll have like a little hexagon gauge over them that you have to break like shield points, and during that time they'll stagger during attacks. You break all of them, you can do a big attack that'll do a lot of damage. I believe new to this game is like this sync strike system where you, when there are nearby allies with you and you guys have your sync strike gauge filled up like to the top left, like, you go by them, you see, like, the L button over your head, and you can, like, pull off this sync strike with them, so you're doing a special attack together, and depending on the character that you're sync striking with, it's all different effects. For example, like, Rauru and Zelda will have two independent laser beams that you can control the aim of independently with the two analog sticks. And then, like, Kalamo and this mysterious construct have, like, this duo sequence where Kalamo throws out different elemental bombs, and then after that Link comes in and does a series of strikes, and then like you're just kind of tapping the attack buttons to like do damage throughout it before a big finisher on them. So they all have different effects, and each character plays pretty differently too, which is really cool. Like Kalamo, for example, really interfaces with the elemental attribute system, where all of its like heavy attacks from its light attack strings all have different elements. Like right, one might finish off with lightning, other ice, other fire, etc. Go for it, James.
It's literally a case where it's like you like if you do one light attack and end off on a strong attack, it's lightning. If you do two, it's ice. Three, fire. Or water, and then five is just like a non-elemental finisher. It's really interesting.
Yeah, and Mineru is really cool because she interfaces like sort of that do-it-yourself build system from Tears of the Kingdom, where she has she's like the kind of like the science research person. She deals with a lot of like building constructs. So in the middle of her like attacks, she'll sometimes like pop out like a cart to like kind of ram enemies with, and some heavy attack finishers have like different constructs, like some of them like it's spotting off like different construct drones that have like swords or arrows that like attack with you and sort of that stuff.
That's really neat about that.
Go for it.
It happens very early on, so it's not really a spoiler. But you can also like the Zonai devices you unlock. You can actually add those to her finishing attacks, and they'll have the elemental properties.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah, that's cool.
Probably the single most broken combo in the game is her light attack, heavy attack, because that has the highest elemental buildup of anything in the game. It's not.
Oh, interesting. Got to take notes here. Yeah, and that, but it's also just every character plays and feels differently, and it's really cool. I was surprised at like how well Zelda's kit moveset comes together, where I really like doing her light attack into heavy attack finisher charged, because that can clear out rooms really fast, and getting access to that attack is fairly early in the attack string, so you get access to it. You don't have to press light attack string into a heavy finisher late into it, and that clears out waves really fast. She has like little orbs that she can do with one of her finishers. So it's like she's like fairly nimble and very like fun to play, because like you can dodge cancel out of her attack finishers fairly easily, because they don't have a long animation wind up time for it, which is really cool. Raoru is like kind of like your powerhouse of the group, with like a big spear, wide range, and it has like interfaces with the Ultra Hand mechanic that you were introduced to in Tears of the Kingdom. So some of his attacks, like, is using that Ultra Hand to attack from, like, very extended ranges, because he's just slapping enemies around with the Ultra Hand throughout his attack tree. He's like, oh, that's really cool, you know? That's a really fun way to, like, go about that mechanic, too.
One thing I really like is that returning from Age of Calamity, you have Interject, which is, like, you'll have these strong enemies do these attacks that have, like, the red aura, and it's like, you look at what the attack is doing, and you know what sort of skills you can use to interject that. And one of the types of attacks you can interject is they'll throw a projectile, and you can either use like eventually a skill that Raoru gets that's Ultra Hand to just like grab it and throw it back. Or Zelda, since she can rewind time with her skills, she can also send it back that way. One of the upgrades you get for a lot of her combo kit is the ability to like rewind the AoE effects of her attacks. And if you do that in the middle of a combo without even doing the skill, right as an enemy is doing one of those attacks that you could rewind to send it back at them, it'll just do it.
Oh, which is really cool. That's really cool. That's a really cool mechanic. And everything, the whole economy of this game feels very fun to progress through. Like before you like do, like, of course there'll be story missions, and some of those story missions sometimes will have prerequisites like, hey, do these stages, but there's like a lot of optional stages too, where like you can recruit a character, or you can upgrade a character's attack and stuff. Sometimes you'll be on the battlefield, sometimes you have to exchange materials to just do a quest right then and there and get like the reward for it, as long as you have the materials needed for it. And it has a good loop of like, hey, if you don't have the materials right then and there for that quest, there's probably another quest, or you just have to do the story quest, and you'll get rewarded with the materials that you'll need to kind of do that right away. So it's not like you're kind of grinding off of somewhere to try to find the drop that you need for this material. It's like, no, just go do other stuff that as it pops up, and you'll be able to do that, you know, fairly shortly. So it's giving you nice incentives to go towards as you're progressing through the game. It's like you have a good incentive, like do side stuff. If there's something optional along the way, you do have a nice incentive to go for that. It's like, hey, I want this, you know, attack string upgrade for this character, and I don't have the material, but I do have a quest I haven't done yet. That'll reward me the stuff I can exchange for that. There's also,
even if it doesn't directly, you can just put the you can put it on the sensor to know where you can get those materials anyways. So.
True. Yeah. And they also have the I don't want to say the gachapon, but like that mechanic in Tears of the Kingdom where you kind of got devices when you put in materials to kind of get stuff out of this gachapon machine. That is sort of in this game too, where you exchange materials into machine and they'll reward you with like the Zonai devices. And the Zonai devices are really neat because you don't build them yourself, but they're all different enough that they have like noteworthy effects. For example, like one of the Zonai devices that you get early on is like this time bomb that if you throw it out, it'll just explode on its own after a certain amount of time. But if you hit it like directly on an enemy, it'll explode on contact, and that'll be good for, you know, getting in a stagger state on them so you can continue the assault. And this all in exchange for battery, like in, you know, the Tears of the Kingdom. But you can combine that with like this Zonai device that sprays out ice particles. So if you build it, if you spray them enough with ice, they'll become frozen. And during that frozen state, you can throw a bomb on them, and that'll cause like a lot of damage because of how they interact with one another, enough to like where they could probably take off several gauges, if not shield gauges, if not the whole thing, for you to do your like big heavy or special attack to do a lot of damage. Like you can shred through boss HP bars if you're playing in a smart manner and like combining different weaknesses and Zonai device effects to lead into like this big finish. I'm playing on hard mode right now.
All right, yeah. I started on normal because I wanted to see like how that felt, and then like after like two stages, I was like, I have to go to hard, and that feels like, if you have played a Warriors game before, at all, hard is the way to go.
For sure, yeah, it's fun. Yeah, because I think things die too fast in normal, and things don't really do that much damage. But with hard, you get enough like an HP increase on enemies that you're able to interface with these mechanics and have to feel like that, like, wow, I did something really cool that just shredded through like almost the entire HP bar of this boss. While in normal, I feel like that you wouldn't be able to interface with that as much, and it kind of feels like it's over too soon.
Yeah.
In that regard. Well, obviously this, like, just within the first 5 hours, James, you know, you've gone through it, you completed it. I don't know much more about, like, I've only done like a few stages throughout this, like when the Blood Moon comes into effect. So I'm interested to know, like, how does this game evolve and what you thought about it? Because you gave a very, very glowing review for this game, and that's one of the main things that motivated me to go, like, I should probably check it out, because I like Mosu games, and this is apparently a very, very, very good one.
Yeah. Like, I think the main negative I could say about the game is that if you want a Musou game where the strategy is paramount, where you're constantly like darting between outposts and defending them, this is not that style of game. It's very story focused. But for what it does with the story, I think I described it on Blue Sky, where it's like it's a decent story for like the majority of it, but the ending is where it really comes together, and it's punctuated by a bunch of cool stuff. Every time the construct flies into the air and does one of those missions, it's going to be the coolest shit ever. Especially since there's a couple of those where it transitions immediately in the middle of that mission from flying into an on, like, foot segment. And I was like, welcome back, Kid Icarus Uprising.
So in the first one of those Star Fox X stages, like, you get introduced also to some parts of the missions. You get to, like, kind of bombard enemies on the ground with that construct in its bird jet mode. And I just thought of, like, oh man, it's Drakengard. Holy shit. And I just, like, oh my god. I'm just imagining, like, can you imagine if, like, they re-released or remastered, remade Drakengard, but, like, with the folks who worked on this game? That'd be awesome.
Yeah.
Wow. But it is really cool to see, like, hey, like, the way that everything feeds into each other in this game really just propels you to, like, discover as much of it as possible. Whether it's, like, there's, like, these aside quests, which are basically very, very small quests that you kind of do. You're not really aiming for them, but you kind of do on the side of, like, hey, go beat up 100 enemies as Zelda, or 3 special attacks as Rauru, or go set up camp with these effects. Like, you know, you're kind of doing these things already, and they reward you further materials and weapon upgrade stuff to go, you know, power up your dudes. And then they'll also reward you with, like, food items and insects that you can put into your camp, because as you're setting up camp, you can actually, like, as to kind of put the cooking equivalent into this game, as you're feeding the pot in camps, you can raise stats up, like movement speed, experience up, raging or increasing the charge rate of either your special attack or your sync strike and so forth. So, like, early on, I accidentally over-leveled Zelda somehow by feeding, like, the first camp that tutorializes you on the pot with, like, a lot of experience up. And I don't know what happened throughout that stage, but, like, my Zelda went up from, like, level 30 to 40 to, like, level 20 or something at the end of that stage. Like, I have no idea what the hell happened, but she is, like, super powered up now to where she isn't supposed to be probably at this point of the game. But I don't know. I just kind of did it. I'm like, all right, sure. Why not? Yeah. You know, so the UI is, like, smartly really presented, where you don't feel like you're getting overwhelmed. Like, everything is pretty much, you know, you can see what is happening in front of you in a very clear, concise manner. Like, I really appreciate that part of the UI. Like, it doesn't feel like I'm getting bombarded by information, which, you know, some Musou games kind of fail in that aspect.
So that is true. For the most part, until you reach the story mission, where upon completion, literally, and Mikhail can back me up here because I recorded it and showed it to him. Literally, I had, like, over 50 icons get added to the map.
Oh, okay, I didn't reach that part yet. All right, yeah, because after, like, you're done with, like, a stage, and, like, especially, like, a story stage that, like, moves the story forward, like, a significant amount, like, you'll see, like, the overview of, like, the map, and you'll see, like, hey, the icons popping up of, like, what is available to do next. So, like, I've only had, like, maybe 8 to 12 of those, like, you know, at most pop up at any time. So, like, okay, this is, like, pretty, like, you know, it doesn't feel overwhelming. But now here, like, oh, at one point, it, like, it'll just unlock, like, 50 of those. I'm like, okay, all right, we'll see. I'll cross that bridge when I get there.
It's a Musou game. Okay. Unfortunately, it comes with territory.
But it's very cool that, hey, they made the case of this being a Switch 2 exclusive. So, and they understood the assignment of, like, we should try to make this game run as smoothly as possible from the get-go. And you know, it's not an Age of Calamity situation, thank God. So it just feels really good to play. Like, just,
yep.
There's nothing that, like, is, like, oh, no concessions about it, pretty much, performance-wise. I really like the way that this game...
The particle effects look insane.
Yes. Like. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very pretty-looking game.
Now, James, you reviewed this game for us, and you scored it very highly, and I know you and Josh have just been going back and forth about, like, things that this game does well. I'm just curious, did you play the other Hyrule Warriors games, or are you just... Like, what approach did you take when coming to, like, I don't want to just say score it, because that's not the most important part.
I owned a Wii U at launch. Of course, I played Hyrule Warriors, like, the original one. What else is I going to play on that thing?
Good point. Did you play Calamity?
I always intended to, but the issues with performance kind of held me back from doing it.
Yeah, these Mosu games, and especially Mosu games, just feel really bad to play in under 60 FPS. Like, even if it's a 30 FPS capped one, I just do not like playing Mosu games like under 60 FPS. It doesn't feel good.
And then Mikhail, did you have any, like, you had a chance to kind of play this on a few of your, like, handheld systems, or no?
I mean, I played Age of Imprisonment as a Switch 2 game, so, like, I could only play it there. But,
I wasn't even thinking. I was thinking, like, the Switch 1 versus Switch 2 comparison, but it's not on.
No. So, for that, it was just, like, revisiting the original Hyrule Warriors and Age of Calamity. Age of Calamity is not dog shit anymore. Hits 30 FPS. Still looks kind of bad on Switch 2, but, it's playable now. Definitive Edition is, like, actually fantastic on Switch 2. Like, if anyone has not played it, now is, like, the best time to get it, because it was always running at 1080p on Switch 1, even in handheld mode and downsampling for some reason. So it just never felt great over there. But now you get, like, 1080, 60 handheld on Switch 2. It's, like, pretty incredible.
Yeah, Hyrule Warriors, Definitive Edition also has, like, a boatload of content. You will get your money's worth, and there's, like, just how many hours you're going to get out of that. There's so many characters.
Definitive Edition is honestly, like, Monster Hunter Generations Ultimate for the series at this point with what they've added to it. But, yeah, Age of Imprisonment, like, I believe James when he said it runs well, and I was like, okay, like, I'll trust him, because, like, I remember, like, usually when I see Nintendo game reviews or, like, impressions, it's always, oh, it runs good for me, and then I'll get it and it'll, like, give me motion sickness or something. So, like, I need, like, trusted impressions. So when he said it was good, I was like, okay. So I was like, how do I cover this now? I want to write about it. And I was like, yeah, you know, I can just do all three together like I do with other series. So, yeah, I bought it on the Australian eShop, so it unlocks, like, half a day earlier. And I played, like, 7 hours of it nonstop, and I wrote what I had to for it. My main, like, obviously Josh and James have spoken about the frame rate, but, like, the particle effects is, like, usually when you have, like, a Musou or Warriors game, they always have these bull shots which make the game look better than it does when you actually play it. But I think this time, and with Dynasty Warriors Origins, are, like, the first two times the game actually looks that good. Like, they aren't bullshitting in those screenshots. So I am very happy with how that is. But I don't know if y'all noticed this. The cutscenes look really bad. Like, I don't know what.
They have a 30 FPS cap, and they
they're all rendered. They're not, like, in
engine. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's not in engine.
Not in engine.
So did any of you play
43 gigabytes to download?
But even that, like, why are they have, like, such low quality video, and it's still so big. But did any of you play the Super Mario Galaxy releases, which they just did, right? Which
Nintendo haven't been able to. No,
because that's kind of similar, where you have the game, it looks really nice, it runs well, and then when a cutscene plays, it's like, oh, like, this is a game from a very long time ago. Like, it just looks really bad, like an old cutscene with, like, art JPEG compression and all that shit. So it kind of reminds me of that. But, like, besides the cutscenes, I really have no complaints with it. I've been enjoying it. And there's one more thing, actually two more things. I don't know if y'all tweaked the camera setting. The default feels really bad. Like, I just put it on maximum camera speed, and I was enjoying myself a lot.
I tweaked a shitload of the settings. Yeah, I always do for most of games.
Yeah, and the other thing is the rumble. I think this game has, like, you know, I was going to say, like, when I played it, I was like, okay, when we discuss it on the podcast, I'm going to be like, oh, it's going to have the best rumble of any Nintendo game, and then I played the Kirby Air Riders beta. So, like, yeah, that's like, that takes the cake for sure. But yeah, they did a good job. The AAA studio at Koei Tecmo, who have good taste in coffee, they did a good job with the rumble, and just technically in general, very happy with the purchase. Gonna be chipping away at it, like, over the next few weeks. Like, I am probably not gonna care much about the story, because, like, I just, like, rolling my eyes at most of the cutscenes so far. Not just because they look bad, but just, like, I can't get myself to care for this. Like, Tears of the Kingdom kind of broke me on that front, but I absolutely adore the gameplay and the music, so.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest challenge that this game kind of faces, like, overall, is, you know, it has a decent story, and I'm sure, like, I've heard really good things about the finale, but it is, aside from Zelda and the Link-shaped mysterious construct, it is pretty much all new characters from top to bottom in this game, and it will really come down to, do you care about these people at all, the overall scope of things? And, you know, that mileage role may vary for a lot of people. I know a lot of people became fans of Kalamo.
Yeah, I will say, without doing any specific things, but it's one thing that kind of becomes immediately obvious in the opening hours. This game story is, like, about Zelda and Rauru and Kalamo and the Construct. Those are the two character dynamics that really matter for the entire story. Everything else is set dressing.
Yeah. And that was like one of the main strengths of, like, the original Hyrule Warriors. Is like, it was pretty much a fan service Zelda game where, you know, you had so many characters from past Zelda games all coming together. So, like, obviously there's going to be way more people will like that better in terms of, like, you remember these characters. Now you can play them as them going batshit insane, killing hundreds of enemies on the field, you know? So it's up and down. I think the only thing that that kind of irks me a little, and this is because I played so many Musou games, is that the lack of voiceover in the actual battlefield segments, where, like, the story cutscenes and a lot of the scenes in general are fully voiced, but when you're on the battlefield itself, everyone is mute. They don't have voiceover. You still have, like, exchanges dialogue boxes, but no voiceover for them. Well, like, I can kind of understand, but a certain element that I like of Musou games is that kind of those battle barks and battle lines of people talking to each other on this chaotic battlefield. And you'll have ridiculous lines like in Dynasty Warriors, when you reach, like, 1,000 kills, you'll have, like, a special line going, like, you are a true hero of the Three Kingdoms or whatever. It's like, it's dumb, but I really like that element of them.
Oh, there's one more thing I want to talk about. Is, like, I think the voice direction for Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom was pretty awful for Zelda herself. Like, the voice actress was really nice, like, in anything else when I've heard her talk. But for some reason, they just did a bad job of the English voices for Zelda in both of those games. I'm happy with it over here so far. Like, I've played about 6 or 7 hours, like, I would say, of voice, because I did replay some stuff in handheld to test. But I am happy with the voice acting and voice direction and music so far. I'm pretty confident in saying that this will be the game I return to more than Tears of the Kingdom, for sure. Because, like, when I finished Tears of the Kingdom, I was pretty satisfied with it. I didn't revisit it like I did Breath of the Wild, but this one I can definitely see myself just coming back to. Like I saw the thing when James streamed it, like, 50 icons popping up. I was like, yeah, this is gonna be a big one.
Josh or James, did you ever have any other final thoughts on Age of Imprisonment? I know James has gotten farther than Josh in terms of, like, seeing the game to the end.
I'll continue, like, you know, playing it here and there. It's going to be tough because Inazuma 11 is coming out very soon, and I'm definitely going to be focusing on that. I'll definitely be playing this, like, in bite-sized chunks, because I do enjoy it. It's like, it's just a smooth playing Musou game. Always down for that. You know, whenever I get some free time. And I'm interested to know the future of Koei Tecmo's newly formed AAA studios, who was in charge of developing this game, because it is a very strong first showing debut project from that studio. So it really makes me wonder what they have next in store, because this caught me by surprise. I'm like, I don't know what to expect from this newly formed studio. I'm sure it has, like, a ton of talented people on it, but you just never really know until they ship something. And based on this, it's like, oh, okay, I'm definitely paying attention to what you're doing from here on out.
Well, thank you, Josh, James, and Mikhail, for going into detail about Hyrule Warriors Age of Imprisonment. We have the review up on the site at rpgsite.net. And then Mikhail has the kind of combo how all of the Hyrule Warriors titles perform on Switch 2. So definitive edition of the original Age of Calamity and Age of Imprisonment.
I was imagining in my head, because when you kind of didn't know if this was Switch 2 exclusive or not, I was imagining Mikhail making a picture of, like, having Age of Imprisonment on Switch 2 running, but then copying and pasting, like, two or three more Switch 2s running it on a coffee table with coffee on it. Here's a comparison on how Age of Imprisonment runs on these four Switch 2s.
Well, I'll be honest, like, I just so rarely play exclusives that sometimes I just don't even consider, like, oh yeah, that's only on that one thing. So a little bit of a brain fart there, my bad. Yeah. But honest,
no, you're good, you're good. You're totally
give
fine.
Give me some slack.
You gave me a great visual in my head that I did
last year. There you go. Yeah, because I am playing, I'm still working my way through ZA, and that's the first time I've really put significant time into my Switch too. Well, with that, I guess we'll move on to the second game, which is kind of like a real big pivot, because we're talking about a game that came out about a month ago at this point. And it's a game that we've talked about in a lot of different contexts in this podcast for like the last several years since it was first announced. Adam, maybe you can look up some of the details for me. Like 2019, I think, might even be earlier than that. Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines 2. So I don't want to go through the whole like history or teeing up entirely, because that would take like half an hour. But basically, they had like one of those augmented reality like ARGs, like I don't know what you call those, where they kept dropping hints and like social medias and Facebooks and Twitter at the time about, are we actually going to follow up in Vampire the Masquerade? Like, because that was like a game from a studio that died as the game released. Cult classic. The game was like famously unfinished. It was never going to be followed up on. Just the idea of a Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines 2, which I'm going to, at this point, just call Bloodlines 2, was just one of those things, or it was almost like a white whale for at least a very small population of fans that were fans of the original. Paradox Interactive, of all publishers, was working with, I believe the original studio was Hardsuit Labs, to work on. They somehow got the rights to the IP, worked with White Wolf, the publisher, to the Vampire the Masquerade, like, whole tabletop game, and they were going to follow up on that game. The project could not get off the ground, could not get its feet under it, so it ended up moved over to a different developer, The Chinese Room, who is more well-known for, like, narrative games. They also did, like, Amnesia, A Machine for Pigs. Not an RPG developer, for an RPG, like, sub-series, like an RPG called Classic. So for Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines 2, it was kind of like this tumultuous development cycle, which is not unusual, unfortunately, on a developer and a publisher that had only really a tenuous connection to the originals. They had brought in the original talent on the game, at least in terms of the writers, but that didn't last very long. So basically, it came down to this question: what is this game? When I read other people's critiques of video games, one of the things that I hate to see, even though it's a little bit irrational, is when people use phrasing like, it's a good game, but not a good Final Fantasy game, or, you know, things like that. And unfortunately, that's kind of where I end up with Bloodlines 2, where I'm like, I'm enjoying this game a fair bit, but it's not a good sequel to Bloodlines. And let me try to at least put some meat on that and at least give it some context rather than just making it a, just like a turn of phrase. So this game, I'll tell you the ways that it's not similar to Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines, which it's been a while since I've played that, but I did play it through a few times between its release and now. Bloodlines 2 has no attributes, no inventory, no currency, no shops, very limited progression at all, to underline that it's barely an RPG. Now, I'm not judging that in terms of, like, therefore it's a lesser game. It's just a very different game. And what it does well are not things that my favorite RPGs do well, in terms of, like, all the things we talk about: progression, resource management, combat, strategy. It does have a good kind of latch on things like narrative, consequence, choices, decisions, those sorts of things. But that's really what it focuses on, and it's truly its one strength. So in that sense, it is a very, very different game from Bloodlines. So anyone going into this game expecting it to be similar to the first game, or maybe not expecting, but hoping that against all odds it ends up feeling like the first game, it really just doesn't. So if that's your criteria about whether or not you're going to enjoy the sequel, and they marketed it as Bloodlines 2, they are saying this is a sequel and it doesn't really feel like it. So if that's an honest takeaway to say, like, well, this doesn't feel like a sequel, therefore I don't like it. I do feel, after having played through it, that if they gave it any other tagline or its subtitle or whatever you want to call it, I think it would have been received better.
I've seen a lot of people make that same suggestion or argument that, like, there are lots of Vampire the Masquerade games, a lot of them more like indie scale or smaller scale games, but we're like with lots of different like interpretations of the, you know, the tabletop, of different styles of games, usually smaller, and, you know, but all with that same Vampire the Masquerade kind of like backing or floor. And this could have just been another one, you know, with some other subtitle, but no, it's trying to be Bloodlines 2, and that's the part where it seems like it just kind of doesn't really work that way, or it doesn't feel right.
Yeah, the circumstances around this project have just... It feels like a losing battle, because you inherited, like, a project that was, like, almost doomed, and so you're inheriting this Bloodlines 2 project from a studio that, you know... various circumstances made it impossible for them to continue. So you inherited it from them. So there's already expectations of a Bloodlines 2 existing. So you can't really publicly message it like, hey, we inherited this project and we're building it from scratch from the ground up. But you can't really go that extra mile to say, oh, by the way, we're not going to make a Bloodlines 2, even though we're inheriting that project. Like, that's a hard thing to message to people, because now you have, like, that invites a whole other realm of criticism and expectations in that regard. And you also have the other angle of this unfortunately doomed project, where the publisher already publicly messaged that they don't have confidence in this project. Like, I remember that interview with Paradox Leadership. That's like, we're never gonna try to make like this sort of RPG project again. And they didn't really elaborate on that any further, but the warning signs were already on the wall well before the release of this game from the publisher themselves, which is a very odd thing to think about and even do at this day and age of in the industry. Like, it doesn't feel good if you're developing that game and your publisher is already saying, we might have fucked up, you know, inheriting this project.
Yeah, I do feel, obviously, we will never really know unless there's some sort of, like, no-clip documentary or something like that, exactly what transpired behind the scenes, who said what meetings were held, what decisions were made early on, late in the game, all those sorts of things. But just looking at the project that did result from it, that you can, you know, purchase and play now, I feel like the developers, to my best capability of the vantage I have, did what they could with what they had and what they were given with the deck they were dealt. So let me just talk about this game, the goods and the bads.
Really quick, sorry. I wanted just to get some context to this, to what Josh was saying.
Okay.
The Paradox CEO said, this is what they said specifically, just to get, like, this is specifically what they said.
Thank you for going into that.
About doing Bloodlines 2, like an RPG game. This is what Paradox said about it. Like, they kind of was like sabotaging themselves about the project. It is not in our strategic direction to make this kind of game. So if Bloodlines 2, God willing, is successful, Bloodlines 3 will be done by someone else. On the license from us, I would say it's the sort of strategic way that this would work. It is an outlier from what we're supposed to do. We don't know that stuff, so we should probably let other people do it.
What an insane thing to say! Like, what are you supposed to take away from that? Of like, that is the furthest thing that is when you're a developer on this game. That is like the last thing you want to hear. Pretty much, it's like, how do we proceed forward then?
It's like asking someone, like a previous employer, for a reference, and they're like, they're not probably the best person you should get. Like, what the fuck? Or something Christ. Like that. But
yeah, go on, Brian. So, yeah.
No worries. No, thank you, Adam, for getting the context, and Josh for kind of teeing that up. But okay, is this game a good game? I enjoyed playing it, and let me try to give you some context for why. Like, it does really fit the mood. And I know these are kind of intangible, so I'll try to like latch them down as much as I can. Like the environment, the art style, the backing tracks, the pace of the game, it does really feel like a similar game in terms of its overall aesthetic. It's not too bright. It's not too cheery, dreary. It does at least feel like it's hitting the same tone and tenor of like if it were like a musical piece or something like that. But it doesn't really have a lot of the, I was going to say it, the RPG mechanics. I was going to try to say it more poetically. But the fact that it doesn't have an inventory, it doesn't have any sort of like stats of like character stats or progression of statistics or anything like that. The fact that it has no currency, like a lot of that, what that means inherently is that a lot of those gameplay systems obviously are either streamlined or completely fall away. So what is left? What's left is basically a branching story with a very kind of basic, fundamentally sound, but basic action RPG-ish system underneath. So first I'll talk about the gameplay and then I'll talk about the story. So the gameplay is still, we kind of talk about how give me a dense, detailed, lots to do, smaller environment rather than like this big sprawling map with nothing in it. This game kind of gets halfway there. It gives you like a dense couple like city blocks of Seattle. And it takes place in like winter 2024. So it's like takes place like in the modern day. And in each area, there's like certain bars or bookshops or hotels or clubs or things that you go into frequently to speak to characters, to do quests, to progress the game story, to take on leads and things like that. So it does feel like it's the idea was to make the city block RPG in terms of like having a dense environment, but it didn't quite get there because outside of the story or like the cases that you have to follow through, in terms of like just being a sandbox or just being a play place, in terms of like being able to exercise game systems, the game just doesn't have that many systems. So what that means is that most of what you end up doing in this, like in the, on the world map, so to speak, is running from objective to objective. And that's kind of it. There are a few other things, so I'll try to be charitable about that. But I wasn't surprised to hear that one of the first mods apparently on Nexus, I did not install this or I can't talk about it, like other than I know that it exists, is people trying to implement a fast travel mod because there isn't one. Because a lot of the game is just like, okay, my next destination's over there, run, have a conversation. Okay, my next destination's over there, run. And so I was just like, okay, I'm not surprised that people are like, give me fast travel. It's one of those games where normally I would say, no, don't give me fast travel. Make me do it. Give me some friction. Make me run through. But there's very little to do between the objective markers. So I could see like, okay, just give me fast travel. So what is
I have a question to build off of that. Yeah. Did you see the clip of someone using like a charge dive kick or drop kicks or to like, they basically got momentum and they start doing drop kicks to quickly travel through Bloodlines too. It seems like the momentum you get from drop kicking like propelled you forward enough to get really fast. I don't know if you saw that clip and if you ever tried to do it.
I did not see that, but I actually am not. So this game is kind of buggy.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I have fallen through the floor. I have found enemies like colliding with the environment, but I had to kill them in order to proceed. So I was like scratching at the wall, trying to kill the enemy stuck behind it. So basically, I know that fundamentally the game needs a little bit of polish. And I know that in combat, when you do drop kick, it does kind of propel you forward. So if you tell me that there's a way to like leverage that to drop kick into the distance, like I'm like, oh, I could see that potentially working.
I imagine it like Super Mario 64 long jumping, but instead of long jumping to move fast, it's just drop kicking. Is that what it is?
Yeah, I'm sure you could make it work. Yeah. Or like in Super Mario, like the trick is like the long jump backwards. If you watch like those tool assisted speedruns or whatever. So I'm not surprised to hear that that's possible, but I have not perfected that myself. So on the map, like if you open up your map, first of all, there are like some basic collectibles, but there's nothing really intriguing about them. There's like marks on the wall that you can like tear down. There's security cameras and there's a few like artifacts that you can pick up. But nothing too extravagant or really deep there. There are people walking around. There's like what it ends up being in this game, both in its gameplay and in its story, is that you will encounter and interface with about a dozen or so vampires that have lived in the city for over 100 years. they represent the different clans. Some of them are very, you know, they've been in Seattle for a long time. Some of them are basically just like, I represent the Brujah clan. Like, they are the, kind of like their avatar, so to speak. And then others are more like story focused characters. I am the leader of the Camarilla in the city. I'm the former leader of the Camarilla in the city. I lead the Anarchs in the city. So a lot of the game, both gameplay and story, is just seeing like how these different powers interact, because all of these people have been basically players in the political space of, and by political, I mean like within the vampire like underworld, within the city for a long time. In terms of gameplay, some of them just give you quests, and then some of them only appear in the story, and then some of them are kind of both. And you, when you pull up your world map, you'll see like quest markers for like who will have an objective for you, and you'll also see like who has different bloodline traits. I believe the traits are choleric. Let me look this up because I don't want to get them wrong. Let's see, bloodlines do bloodline traits. They're color coded to be like three different colors, either red, blue, or purple, and the bloodline traits are either choleric, sanguine, or what's the third one? I apologize, Adam. You'll have to get, either edit this out or just let me stumble. Melancholic. Oh, there you go.
There you go.
There you go. So basically, you'll see a little marker on a map, and it'll be like a little red symbol. And what that means is that there's an NPC in the area that has very choleric blood. And basically, it ends up being basically just color-coded. Like, if they have red blood, they will be very aggressive, and they will chase you, and they'll want to attack you because they want to rob you or shoot you or whatever. Of course, you are an elder vampire, and they have no chance. But you don't want to kill them in public because you got to maintain the masquerade. The masquerade is basically a bar at the top of your screen that shows you that you are not, you know, sucking blood, running up walls, super sprinting, or whatever in the presence of mortals. And if you do that too frequently, it is a game over condition, where if you break the masquerade, you end up getting kicked back to your most recent checkpoint. Oh, that's one thing I should bring up. This game is saving is checkpoint only. You cannot manually save. I'm sure you can figure it out with like PC, like file manipulation. But in terms of as intended, there is no option to save the game. It saves for you in one spot, and that's it. Which I actually kind of like, because that means there's no saves coming. There's no like backing up your save. I'm sure you could figure it out on PC. There's no like wanting to make a different choice. There's no, oh, I fucked up. Let's see if I can do that more cleanly or more stealthily to get the bonus objective or whatever. It's like, nope, you get what you get. So I do actually kind of like that. It's like Iron Man light in a way. But in terms of the masquerade, you try to lead people into alleys or like on, you know, empty streets before you suck their blood. If people are melancholic, they'll run away from you because they're fearful and they're scared. If they're sanguine, you basically seduce them and you can bring them wherever you want. So it's kind of like interesting on paper, but in terms of gameplay mechanic, it's super bare bones. It almost feels more like a prototype than anything, where basically you just have 3 meters. How much red points, blue points, and green points do you have? And the more that you find of different characters who have those different blood types, the more points you get. And you use these to unlock abilities. That is the extent of the game's progression, is getting points of sanguine, choleric, or melancholic as you find these people in the world and using those to unlock abilities. The abilities are assigned to a different clan. These are like the clans per like this interpretation of Vampire Society per, you know, Vampire the Masquerade, like the Tremieres, the Toradors, the Brujah, the Lombrosa, the Sombra. So they all kind of have different specialties. And the idea is that active abilities that you get are assigned to a different clan. So you pick a clan and you get a passive for that clan. Like, for instance, I pick Torador. And what that is they're the ones that like to seduce people. So as you suck someone's blood, it gives you a speed boost so that you can get away from the cops easier. Other ones, some of their passives, I believe, are like, they can't take damage if you are sucking someone's blood. So even if you're like are in a place that the cops can shoot at you, you're not actually going to die, but you are going to get them mad, things like that. But the thing is, it just feels like a system that could be good if it had a little bit more to it, but it just feels like a prototype. And also, it's so easy to run away from the cops, where, like, instead of seducing someone or luring them to a back alley, I'll usually just chomp them on the street, and then it'll be like, you're breaking the masquerade, warning signs, sirens, and then I just run away and wait till everything calms down. And they're like, oh, I guess it was nothing, and life goes on. So it ends up feeling like a little bit underbaked, like not terrible, but I just wish there was more to it. Thanks, Adam. Just a comment that he put in the chat for a suggested title for this podcast. Unfortunately, all the side quests of the game are very bare bones and almost feel prototype-ish as well. They're just like, use your Witcher senses to find this person and deal with them, but don't break the masquerade, or pick up this package and bring it to another person in town, or literally just fight these goons in the city block. And so all the side quests feel like Skyrim Radiant quests. Like, there's very little, basically no story behind them. They don't build or lead to anything. They are just an opportunity to run around the city, kill a guy or bite a guy, and then get some experience. All of your experience is only used to upgrade abilities. So all of the progression is combat-based. You either unlock abilities by trading in your blood points or leveling up your EXP and unlocking them. And that's all of the progression in the game. So it's RPG-ish in that sense, but also the combat's probably the worst part of the game. So it really is one of those things where it just feels like it doesn't line up quite right. It's like you baked your pie upside down. All the progression is combat-related, and the combat is very average. So that means if you don't like the combat, the progression feels kind of meaningless. And if the progression feels kind of meaningless, it makes all the side quests completely pointless. So you kind of see where it just sort of falls apart. In terms of the systems don't build on each other, or they don't latch together in smart, compelling ways. That was kind of like my main thesis, is that this could be good if only this changed, but in order for that to be good, this would have to be different. In order for that to be good, I would set it up something like this. And it just feels like more of a prototype than anything like that. So why did I say at the start that I actually enjoyed playing this game? And as silly as it sounds, it is because I really enjoyed the story. And it's whenever I read some reviews for this game as I was playing through it, because I wasn't actually tapped to review this. I'm just playing it. And I wanted to see, like, well, how did this game release? You know, what reception did it have? And I saw some people talking just like, the characters are shallow, the story doesn't make sense. But I'm sitting here being like, but I'm enjoying it. It's a lot easier, I think, to tear down a story than explain why you actually like it, other than just being like, I'm a mark, or I'm simple-minded, or I'm easily impressed, I guess. But I'll try my best. So the story, one thing that I wasn't expecting going into Bloodlines 2 is that there's basically two protagonists. So I'm sure that if I followed the pre-release media more carefully, I would have known that.
Just on that note, that's not your fault. The way they introduced this pre-release was very weird and sudden. For the longest time, okay, the only protagonist was Fire. That was the protagonist. Is that how you pronounce it? But and then, yeah, like, kind of all of a sudden, this was like 2 months ago, or very close to release, they're like, by the way, there's this whole mechanic and system in the game where you, like, go back in time in your mind or something, and there's another character. I actually don't even know exactly how it works. So it's not just you. The way that they introduced this kind of dual protagonist system was strange and sudden. So go for it.
So very early in the game, you wake from a long sleep called torpor. It's basically like vampire hibernation. If I say anything that's like not completely correct, like my exposure to White Wolf Vampire the Masquerade is just two games separated by 20 years. So I'm not an expert. But you wake up from torpor. You are Fire. That is the character you play as in the game. But in your head is another vampire named Fabian. Now, when one vampire like absorbs another, you're supposed to be able to gather their powers. But it's kind of like very... what's the opposite of sacrosanct? It's like very, don't do it. Like, that is breaching code. That is not something you're supposed to do, but you kind of did it. You didn't intend to do it. But then, for reasons that that are not explained until like very late in the game, Fabian, you didn't just absorb his power. This is like the setup of the game. This is like the premise. You didn't absorb his power, but he's stuck in your head. So basically, it's very... I hate just doing this, but it's very Johnny Silverhand in Cyberpunk, where it's like, oh, there's a dead guy in your head, but it's like, that's kind of what it is. And he is also a vampire, So you choose like what clan you are, but Fabians, I'm going to get the term wrong, Malkavian. So they are the vampire that is a little bit like diet schizophrenic, where they can speak to objects, they have memory problems, they can like trick people into perceiving the world differently. And Fabian was a detective that lived at least as early as the 1920s. It doesn't actually say like how old he was at the time. Actually, it does imply that his embrace when he became a vampire was soon before then. So he's from like the early 1900s. He gets embraced, which means another vampire like sired him and made him, you know, a kindred. And he basically is in your head, but his memories are all tangled up and you don't know why. You end up kind of realizing that, okay, your fates are intertwined in some fashion. You don't know why you ended up awake now in Seattle in 2024 with this detective from the 1920s in your head. And why is that? Oh, and then the last thing is that there's a mark on your hand that no one seems to know what that means. And you cannot leave the city or else you die. So that's kind of like the big premise of the game is like, what is this? Why are there two people? And why am I stuck? What is the goal? So obviously someone imprinted that on you. Someone is like using you as a tool, but you don't know why. And the whole game is kind of like this big mystery with murder mystery aspects and interplay between the Camarilla, which is like the stratified, almost fascist, like vampire society, and the Sabbat, which are like this anarchal, beastly, don't care about the masquerade vampire like society. Like they were two big opposing forces in the original game as well. So in that, this game does feel like it at least fits the setting. But Fabian probably at least actually has more dialogue, more voiceover than Fire. Because Fire is kind of like, he speaks, he's not a silent protagonist, but he kind of like speaks what your dialogue choices tell him to. But Fabian talks all the time, and I don't actually know who his voice actor is, but his voice actor is really good. Like, I really enjoy like listening to the dialogue. He is just a well-portrayed, deep character, and he struggles because someone messed with his memory. So it's a lot of things where like he recognized something, but he doesn't understand why, or he swears he's having deja vu because he perceived something before, but that memory was stripped away from him. But now he doesn't have his own body. He's stuck with Fire. So Fire has to feel empathetic towards him. Of course, this game being RPG light, you can like be a piss off to Fabian. You can be like, shut up, you know, crawl in the corner of my head and don't speak up. But why would you want to do that? He's a nice dude. He seems like he's really trying his best.
He has a great voice.
He does have a really good voice actor. And yes, this game. So in the original Bloodlines, if you pick the Malkavians, you can like speak to a stop sign or speak to a TV. Like it's supposed to be very silly, but like he's a detective. So like early on in one of his sections, cause you kind of trade off playing as Fire and playing as Fabian, like, oh, this body is dead, but I can just speak to the dead body and try to get some clues. Or, oh, there's a murder note. I'm going to let the note speak to me. Who wrote you note? And it's just kind of like, oh, a Malkavian detective actually is pretty inspired because he can like speak to things to learn like what the evidence has to say to get a lead or get some clues. So it's actually like, you know what? I like that. And the cool thing is all these vampires are immortal, right? So you first meet them. There's almost like three time periods that you explore this game. There's the present where you play as Fire. There is the recent past where you play as Fabian, like I think it's like 6 months prior, where everything is contemporary, but it's before Fire wakes up, and you're seeing a lot of the same characters, and you're trying to piece together who was what, at what point, in what order, and who was, you're trying to like put together the timeline, like why, who had what motivation, who has an alibi, who doesn't. And then you get pushed back to the very distant past of when Fabian was first sired, and it's a lot of the same characters because they're immortal, so you could see like, oh, who was the prince at this time? Who, you know, where was everyone 100 years ago? And they do play with some cool, like, real world history. I'm not from Seattle, but I do know about like the late 1800s or early 1900s Seattle fire that burned down like the residential district, and they had to like build a new city on top of it. And there's like the Seattle Underground, which is like a tourist where you can see like the original ground level of a lot of the existing buildings that was damaged by the fire. So they play with that in fun ways to be like, why did that actually happen? A vampire prince of the area had to like hide the evidence of something that happened back in the past. And it's like, you know what? That's pretty fun. I actually kind of appreciate them playing with the real history like that to make a fictional history that yeah. is suited to the game and its setting. So that's pretty cool. I think the thing I like most about the story is that there are characters who you have to get along with, but they don't trust you. They are very self-serving. They wield power, and some of the people wield power in different ways. Like the Bruja, they're very like, they trust their own capability in terms of like they lead at the head of the wolf pack. I shouldn't say wolf pack because that implies werewolf, not werewolf. They lead at the head of the pack. They are the most capable like physically and like vampirical prowessy of their clan, versus like the Tremere who like wield leverage and wield like buy off or like getting people to be on their side in terms of like a more societal like sort of power in terms of being able to bring people to their way of thinking. And it's interesting to see a lot of characters interact, some that have been kindred for a long time, some that are recently kindred and vying for power, in terms of this one character used to be the prince but gave that up. Why would they do that? So they don't effectively have power anymore in terms of they're no longer explicitly the prince, which is like the head Camarilla in any area. But they're the former prince and they still have a lot of contacts. So they can do a lot of things kind of outside of the limelight, so to speak. Like they no longer have the spotlight on them. You've got the new prince who is a younger character named Ryong, and she is the prince. So she like officially has power, but people don't trust her or they don't like respect her because she's the new prince. So her power is wielded in a slightly different way. She has to be more showy about it. She has to like show people like, yep, I am actually in charge and I need to demonstrate that. And there's also characters who like, I have no ambition to sit on the throne. I just kind of want to build my own little kingdom here, you know, away from the Camarilla where they don't bother me. And then I can just kind of build my own station here in my own way. And throughout the game, you have to choose like, do I side with the prince? Do I side with the former prince? Do I side with the anarchs? Do I kind of just look out for myself? And the characters are all well voice acted, in my opinion. I think a lot of the dialogue, there's so many times where I'm like, I don't know like what the right thing to do is. So I just need to kind of go with my conviction. I'm not going to try to please everyone because a lot of these people are assholes, but I need to please a few people. Otherwise everyone's going to be out for me. And seeing it play off in the story, of course, since you can't checkpoint easily, it's not easy to discern like how thorough the branches are in terms of like as a game, how much do your choices really matter. But I do know that it has 6 different endings and you get to pick a different clan at the start. So there is a lot of replayability in terms, at least on paper, though it's a long enough game, like 30 hours or so, that I don't know. I almost wish that if it was a little bit shorter so that I'm more inclined to just replay it and pick different options. Cause right now I'm just like, okay, I just beat it. I was a Torador. I made a certain choices and I got a certain ending, but I have really no desire to see more, especially since early on in the game, it would be a lot of the same story beats until it really starts to branch out at the end, presumably. But it is a story that is well told. I do feel like as a protagonist, you do get a lot of say in how the story unfolds, at least in terms of like the characters. And that's really where this game, I think, shines the most. But if you really are looking for like an RPG to get lost in, or even just an RPG with a fun little sandbox, a fun little progression system, a fun little District of Seattle to run around in and like do your vampire fantasy, you get a little bit of that here, but it's more of a narrative based game than anything, which sounds like the obvious conclusion based on who was developing it. But I didn't enjoy the game less because of that. I actually thought like, okay, this is the type of game that I normally wouldn't play, but I'm glad that I did. And it does feel like it fits the vibe of the setting. It just doesn't feel like a Bloodlines 2. So that's kind of like I wrapped it around back to the start in terms of it's a good game, but not a good sequel to Bloodlines. So hopefully I was able to at least put a little bit of context behind a tagline like that.
No, it definitely makes sense. I just unrelated to or kind of related. Did you play Stalker 2?
No, I haven't.
So when Stalker 2 came out, they had the Alive system, which is their big feature, which they promoted and all, and it shipped underbaked. And I had a lot of people call it. They just said Stalker 2 doesn't feel like a Stalker game because of that. And like now it's releasing and it's had multiple updates and stuff. And now people are happy with it. So I was just thinking, do you think they could like update and patch and like tweak this into something which you'd consider a good follow-up? Or do you think there's no base at all for that?
So in terms of like story, I'm gonna try to answer your question, though it might be a little bit roundabout. Like, not only is this not really a good sequel to Bloodlines 2 gameplay wise, but the story is pretty unconnected as well. So like, I would almost see this as its own game. And then also, I would just try to play the game to its strengths. Like this game, if the combat is too, like the combat, I didn't really talk about the combat much. It's very like hectic. It's a very like a lot of running around and spamming your attack buttons. Like to enjoy this game to its fullest, I think it's just like play on easy. There are a few achievements that you have to play on normal or hard, but like don't care about. Just play on easy. The gameplay, I don't think is worth that. It's kind of like cutting your losses, where it's like I'm looking at Bloodlines 2 and I'm like, patch up the bugs, of course. I don't want to fall through the floor or fight enemies colliding with a geometry. But if you want to experience this game and enjoy it to its best possible extent, I would say like play it on easy, enjoy the story, role play as your vampire in a narrative sense. And then in terms of like a follow-up, Bloodlines 3, that's a really hard question to answer, because just like, I guess the idea would be have as equally a good a story, but build on like do the other part better, which is, I know, like asking for the sun and the moon. It's just like, it would be awesome if this game had if the story was as good as it is, and it had all those systems underneath, like to really bake it into like a game that you could have a different build style or a different play style, or really flesh out the environment or the side quests or like other sorts of ways of progressing your character. Like that would be, if that's something that they all kind of have in scope for a Bloodlines 3, that's kind of like, that would be the golden middle, right? That would be like a little bit of everything that we'd want. But in a world where you have to like play concessions in terms of like, okay, do I want a game more like Bloodlines 1 but finished and polished, or a game that's in the vein of Bloodlines 2? I'd almost be like more like Bloodlines 2, but just now that everyone's expectations are calibrated, and like, don't call it Bloodlines 3, call it Vampire the Masquerade, and then whatever other subtitle fits whatever project you're presenting. Unless they were to get, because I'm trying to think, like the publisher Paradox, who owns the IP, it would almost be like a different developer if they are really going to like try again, take a mulligan on Bloodlines 2 and try again at making a sequel to Bloodlines 1. It's like back to the drawing board, back to 2019. Only it has to be a different developer underneath their umbrella to tackle that project. But in the case where that's not the case, I would just say follow up on Bloodlines 2, focus on your strengths. Don't call it a sequel to Bloodlines 3. That's kind of where I'm landing. Hopefully that answered your question. I know it's a little bit roundabout.
No, it did.
But yeah. So if I were to score it, it'd probably be like a strong 7. Like what it does well, it does really well. What it does poorly is almost like prototype poor in terms of like, it would be better if it was removed entirely. Some of the things that they tried but didn't really land on, side quests and things like that. But it's a game that I'm really glad that I played.
Yeah, it's a tough situation because, like, going into it, you already have a large chunk of your audience already has expectations, and the best thing, the healthiest thing for that game would be to be removed from those expectations. But it's impossible in this scenario because of its development history. That, like, there's just no way they could drop the title at all.
Mm-hmm. And we do have one more game to quickly touch on before we go into some news sections here. And this is a game that we've talked about a few times when it was in early access and when its final release finally got announced just a few weeks ago. This is Eruta. And I know Chao, I believe, played this when it was in either early access or a Steam demo, but you've also just recently played through it now with its full release. So Chao, do you want to kind of remind us what this game is? And then just kind of tell us like what your final impressions of it were now that you're able to play through and finish the complete game.
So Aritha is like a roguelike RPG that plays kind of like Dave the Diver. Basically, you collect materials, and then, you know, once you go for your run, you bring back the materials to make bread, and you sell the bread, and then you use that money to get upgrades and stuff, and then you go for another run. So it's like a very simple gameplay loop, right? I did talk about it before, and the final release does have some major changes, which is having the final weapon, which I was waiting for, because in the prologue of the game, the protagonist picks up 3 different weapons, and one of them you just can't use it, and you're like, why? It's like, well, the game's incomplete. So the weapon she picked up is a rolling pin. The second weapon is a whip. So throughout my entire game, I mostly played for the whip, but then the third weapon is finally included, which is a rapier, which is what that blue thing was. I didn't know what it was. I thought it was like a stick. I thought it was like a wand. I don't know what it was, but until the final release, it's a rapier. And so I played through the last third of the game with the rapier because, you know, it's a new weapon. Of course, I'm going to use the new weapon, right? So it beat the game. I think the rapier is actually very powerful, actually, in this game. Because you get, like, a parry button with that, because it doesn't have, like, this ability. Like, most weapon, like, your B button is, like, a special ability, but that rapier is, like, a parry, and the parry is so good in this game. It's like having, like, a one more invincible dodge button, you know? And the boss in this game are really hard, so I think it's kind of like having that extra parry button is, like, very overpowered for this kind of gameplay loop.
Mm-hmm. So, just... For people who don't know, like as Sean mentioned, this is much in the style of, like, even though it has that Dave the Diver loop of, like, hey, you're going through a run to gather materials to go back to like a shop management bakery to, you know, to manage like a bakery to serve the customers. Like, the gameplay itself is like, it's almost like a beat 'em up. It's a side scroller beat 'em up roguelite. So you're going through, like, from, like, room to room, to building up to a boss, and as you're going through these, like, rooms, you're getting different, like, improvements and enhancements to, like, your attack power and different play styles in that style, right, Chao?
Yeah. So there's this character. I have a very hard time remembering the characters' names because a lot of them starts with a C.
I believe the main character's name is like Chaya, I believe.
Yeah, her name is Chaya, but there's like other girls. Like there's a scientist girl called Chilala, and there's like another one which is like Chiba. Is like it's very hard to remember these character names, and you just kind of like look at their sprites because they all start with like a CH, and you're like, how am I going to remember everybody? You know, it's like
yeah. And but, I assume, different NPCs, like, do they, like, have different functions when you, like, go back to, like, your home base or sort of non-combat sections to help you improve stuff along the way?
Yeah, there's all these NPCs that come in, and they will help you through various means. Like, one of them, like, the scientist girl, will sell you badges. And if there's also, like, this other girl that does, like, construction. Basically, you pay her the mats, and she will upgrade the building level, and then it also unlocks other functions too, right? Like, one of the biggest change in the final version is they included pets. Apparently you can tame monsters in the wild and you could use it as your worker in a bakery, and one, like, the first thing is like we hire animals in fair labor laws or something like that.
Okay, well, that's good. I mean we love fair labor laws.
So it's like, so you could bring pets to your shop to work, and then your pay is kind of like taken out of their wages to pay them, technically, right? Mm-hmm. So there's that. So they added pets as like a new feature in this game, and you basically can use them to, like, was it gather materials, like an exhibition, like in gacha games, where you could send them away and then they come back with materials for your shop or something like that, right? So you could do that. And so that's like the biggest change. What am I trying to say is, yeah, like, I think the game is solid. I think it's a little bit shorter than I expected. It's like, they only, like, after waiting almost nearly a year, I think. Is it a year? Oh, I don't know. It's been a while. Like, and they only included, like, one final island, and that was it. And I feel like they were trying to, like, drag out the content a little bit by trying to have, like, very difficult bosses that you would keep redoing the loop. So it's like, oh... It's like, but I think if you're like playing on like a much easier difficulty, I think you could just stream roll the game, I think. But I play in the regular difficulty, so I don't know how easy the easy mode is, right?
Okay.
Because the bosses in this game is, like, I think is the best part of the game, because the boss fights feels like playing, like, a Toho, like, bullet hell in a Mega Man setting. They're like, okay, here's a million bullets, how are you going to dodge it? Or, like, an FF14 raid, right? It'll be like, you see, like, all these lines that cover the entire screen, and you're like, how am I supposed to dodge this? And then there's, like, that one split second of where the safe spot is, right? You know, it's like, you kind of, like, know, and then, but the thing is, like, once you die, you have to do the entire run up the dungeon to get to the boss again, and I think that's one of the, like, criticisms of the game, is that it's a very difficult game, because the bosses are difficult, and you don't get to, like, retry them, unless you do, like, the entire
It's hard to, like, practice them until, like, you have to build up to them again to actually get that practice run in.
Yeah, so, like, they added, like, a revive in, like, the second version of the game, like, the previous revision. It's like, but you only can use one revive, right? And that revive is, like, and then if you use some healing items, it's like, oh, you don't get the healing items on your, like, revive.
Oh, wow.
So it's, like, a little bit... Yeah, it's, like, a very punishing way, so you don't really get to learn the pattern too much until you just, like, have to, like, stream roll it, right? Like, but once you master the pattern, it's, like, you can, like, stream roll the boss, I think. So I think that's a good thing. Like, most video games, like, you don't really, like, learn the pattern because you just kill the boss before you, like, understand how the mechanics works. Because in this game, you kind of get killed in, like, 4 hits, so you have to, like, make sure you learn it, right?
I see. Did you ultimately, like, beat the entire game?
Yeah, I did. I beat the entire game.
So what does story progression look like in this game? Because the different games with roguelike mechanics advance the story in different ways. Like, you advance the story by, like, beating a run and then it'll move the story forward, or is it like one of those things, like, you reach a point in that run and then you're taken out for story progression and it'll unlock the next part that you do.
So you basically beat the stage and you unlock the next part, and then every time it's like, and sometimes maybe they will prevent you from going to the next part until you complete these quests. So the last one, they were just like, it felt like Final Fantasy 16, but in a lighter scale, you know, where you just beat this, like, boss that you assume is the last boss, but it's not really. And then it's like, oh, you had to sell 300 bread, or you have to beat this boss again to start. It's like, it felt like Final Fantasy 14.
Like a bunch of, like, you have to do a checklist, prerequisite list to actually start, like, the true final path or whatever.
Yeah, you have to do, like, all these, like, checklist things before you're allowed to, like, do, like, the final thing. And then, you know, it's like, certain quests is like, yeah, they just let you progress right away. Some, they have certain things to stop you, right? But that's kind of, like, the bit gameplay loop. The story is kind of, like, whatever at the end. It felt like, okay, it's like, I don't really remember too much of the characters, because some of the characters, you get to interact with them, right? And the more friendly you are with them, there's like a kind of like a bonding event, sort of like Persona games, where you, like, every time you talk to them, their heart goes up. And then when they raise a certain level, is like, you know, you get to watch this bonding event and they'll talk about their backstories, right? And, you know, it's like, if you get really friendly with them, they actually even, like, willing to participate in your bakery and help you as a worker, right? And they give you, like, some bonus, like, I don't know, they'll help bread sell better in that day, or give you more EXP with bread, right?
Yeah. So, but I think overall reception to it seems to be very fairly positive based on, like, you know, what people have been, the Steam reviews that have been put up.
I think it's a very good game. I think my favorite part is still the boss fights. I would love to, like, just kind of, like, do, like, a boss rush challenge.
Instead of just,
like, going through the whole roguelike element to it. Because the roguelike is kind of, like, it's just, like, a nuisance trying to get to the end, really, right? You just want to get to, like, the boss, right? Because I think the boss are insanely fun. It's just that there's not much of it. I think there's, like, 12 bosses, I guess? Or 13 bosses, I would assume. And... Yeah. Yeah. I also assume that the second last boss was the last boss, because she had, like, 3 forms. Well, the last boss only had, like, 1 form, and it's like, oh, this pattern's so easy, I figured it out with my second try, right? And you, like, get to fight it, like, immediately, and, like, unlike the other bosses where you had to, like, go through, like, a whole, you know, the roguelike dungeon to get to it, the last boss you just get to fight immediately. So I felt the last boss was a little disappointing compared to the second last boss, which felt, like, the big bad, everything is all at one. You know, that's kind of like my only grief with it, right?
But, I mean, sometimes yeah. I do like the idea of, like, the last boss is a victory lap, and the penultimate boss is really like the challenge. Like the two games I think of are like Dark Souls and Final Fantasy X, where the last boss is not a challenge. But and I don't know if that's
Final Fantasy IX or Final Fantasy IX. It'll be like
I don't remember IX. I don't remember as well, honestly.
But the last boss of Final Fantasy IX is actually hard compared to whatever, you know. But the thing is, this kind of came out of nowhere. It's just like, oh, who is this dude? I have never heard of this guy unless you read the.
Are you talking about Final Fantasy IX or Aruto right now?
Well, no, I'm just saying like a IX, you know, like the last boss just kind of came out of nowhere, so it became an unmemorable experience, right?
But, right. Well, I was just talking about, like you mentioned in Aruto, the last boss was a little bit of a letdown, only in one phase, and I was like, well, is it meant to be like a victory lap, or is it just sort of like?
No, oh, it wasn't a victory lap. It was just like this. There's like these backstories that they included. It's like about the lore, but there's some war, and they like sealed up something, and you just go in there and you just fight this thing. And it's like, oh, that was it. It's like,
so you're just too good. You're too good of a gamer, is what it was. there you go.
Yeah.
It's like, but, yeah.
Well, we'll see. I mean, they're not done like supporting the game. It seems like I was looking at their like the Steam news post for like the 1.0 version of this game, and they're gonna they say that you're gonna continue improving and revising like existing content, and then adjusting new content based on feedback. It seems like their plans to support it aren't done.
Because even if you beat the game, I mean, like technically. Like the story still goes, it's like playing a Harvest Moon game. Once you like see the credits, the game's not exactly over. I mean, you could still keep, you know, playing the game to improve your character, right? So I guess like maybe they add more post games in the content in the future. Because somebody in the Steam post asked them, is like, hey, are you going to release this game on a console? And they're like, well, we're still improving the game in the future, so we're in the talks about that. So maybe the final version of the game is when they port it to consoles, I guess.
But. Yeah, we'll see. Yeah, but it's cool that like, you know, it seems like it's been fairly like successful and by their own like, you know, merits, like a pretty like a low key sort of release. But for the people who got to try it out, they seem to really gravitated towards it. And hopefully, it continues to, like, you know, see future success, whether it is like future versions or other platforms.
Look, I see this game on James's wish list. Maybe should I get it for him just to support this company, because the game is actually going on sale very cheap right now. It's only $12.
Yeah, it sounds like on minus 20% off, but that'll be done within a few days as of this recording. There's the studios for Skin is from the developers from Dawn Games, and from what it seems like, it seems to be like their debut project. It seems to be fairly well put together.
Yeah, I definitely enjoy it. I think it's like, I felt the game was a little bit shorter than I expected, but I guess for its price tag, it was totally worth it, I guess.
Yeah, I think price tag and also just like developer scope and ambitions. I think it's good to start out small instead of starting big right away for like your first or one of your early projects, right? So take the lessons learned that you got from this development, and when you're going to the next one, you know, see what you can, you know, make better, build upon like the experience that you got from your earlier titles. So I think even though it might be on the shorter side, it's ultimately probably healthier for the company to go this route for future endeavors.
I'm just going to post a screenshot. Like, if you look at that screenshot, that...
Okay, this we can't do this on audio podcast. Let me describe the screenshot. You shared a screenshot from a boss pattern, and one of the bosses is like, it's like basically... laser beams have filled up the screen from top to bottom, and like it's all separated by multiple laser beams firing vertically and horizontally, and so you have to find like pockets of a 3x3 pockets in the arena to dodge them. And I assume these laser beams all hurt if they touch you. So that is the screenshot that you shared with us as I'm describing this on this audio podcast.
Imagine you have a piece of Chex Mix, the cereal, underneath a microscope, and okay. The lines that are hatching like vertically and horizontally, between those are your safe spots, and they're very small, and that's where the character is.
There you go.
I've described it. You did.
We need to remember the audio-only podcast.
Yeah, but it's like, you're trying to find a safe spot. It'll be like Final Fantasy XIV, you're like, there's like a billion things blowing up everywhere, but the safe spot's always that one corner, so you know where to go after like dying a few times, right?
There you go. Thank you, Chow, for talking about the full release of Aruta, and sounds like it is a fun experience that is not, you know, not too pricey and is on sale right now. So if you're listening to this early, you might be able to get it on PC for cheap, and it might be coming to consoles, you know, in the future. Before we go on to like article shoutouts and news, just programming note, Josh, do you have to step out or are you good for another bit or so?
I can stay for like maybe 10 to 15 minutes more.
Okay. Same, so yeah. Before we go into headlines, well, that's good for Mikhail, because before we go into headlines, there's just a couple of other features on the site for games that we've talked about in previous podcasts. You were able to put up an interview with Dragon Quest 1 and 2 HD 2D producer Hayasaki Masaki. Hayasaka Masaki. And talking about how Dragon Quest 1 and 2 was envisioned compared to Dragon Quest 3 HD 2D remake. Do you have any key takeaways from this interview that you wanted to like share on the podcast?
Yeah, so if anyone listening has played Dragon Quest 1 and 2 HD 2D remake after playing Dragon Quest 3, at least to me, it feels like a bigger scope project. Like a lot more has been done to it to like pretty up the game, new cutscenes. They have like new additions. So I was curious to ask him about like how the team approached both games separately, whether Dragon Quest III's success allowed them to do more here. And then also because Dragon Quest 1 and 2 HD2D remake have extra features, like we've spoken about these before, like you can have like the secret spots and treasure chests on the map, you can like disable healing and like recovering HP MP when you level up and stuff. So I also asked him whether like is there any chance that'll be patched into Dragon Quest 3, and to that he literally just said that it might seem like it's easy to do, but it's a lot more complex, and if Square Enix gives them the budget, they'll do it basically. And then yeah, I was just like talking to him about how like they approach the project, and very interesting conversation. Was happy to have it done because like I did a lot around Dragon Quest 1 and 2, so like this was a nice way to cap it all off. And I'm curious to see how it does long term. And yeah, I have had so many people ask me that, you know, like when you do interviews with Square Enix, can you tell them to like do a physical release? And I know that's like saying this stuff doesn't mean much, but I was like, sure, why not? So I just said that like I think you should consider, like I hope you consider doing a physical Switch 2 bundle with all three games. And I just got like a diplomatic yes, understood, I'll bring it up with the higher ups or whatever. And yeah, and then the
acknowledged.
yeah. And the ending is like, I joked about this on Blue Sky, but like, yeah, I just said, how do you like your coffee? And he's like, I don't usually drink coffee. So I joked that as much as I love Dragon Quest 1 and 2, it's unfortunately not on my game of the year list anymore. But yeah, it was fun interview to do. And unfortunately, like it was done before I ended up playing the game on, like, I asked him a few technical questions also, like, you know, like what should players expect when they play it on like consoles and PC? Will it be the same? This was obviously before I had played it on like everything. I had only played it on like Steam Deck and Switch 2 at that point. So yeah, it is pretty similar to what you get with the with Dragon Quest 3. But he did say that the team ran into additional challenges. Like it optimizing for the original Switch was harder. So yeah, he did say that. Yeah, but yeah, that was a fun interview to do.
It's always cool to see like while you know, game developers are, you know, the game players themselves. So it's always nice to. I really like your question about, hey, like what games did you enjoy this year? And Masaki seems to have enjoyed Silent Hill F a lot. Seems to be like the game he enjoyed most this year. And it's also interesting, like. He's obviously, you know, sort of biasedly, maybe, like he's looking forward to Dragon Quest VII Reimagined. But even, like, throughout, like, hey, I was from that generation that grew up with Dragon Quest VII and completed it, like, 3 or 4 times himself. I'm like, damn, that is a relatively a lot of completions of Dragon Quest VII.
Yeah, that's dedication.
Even if it's just, like, the handheld version, like, it is a long-ass game, no matter which version, prior version you're playing. So having done more than 2 completions of it is quite a lot. You must really love that game and to play it and beat it that much.
And then Mikhail, we talked about this game slightly last week and we kind of punted a few of the discussions to this week. You were able to put more time into the recently released Tales of Xillia Remastered. This is not really a full game review, but more of just like about the remaster. So it fits kind of this release. Like, You were able to look at the remaster on PS5, Switch, Switch 2, and I believe Steam Deck. Yeah. So, and maybe, I'm sure I missed a few, because this game is not exclusive to just one console. just tell us about the remaster and what your impressions are playing it across a couple of different consoles.
Yeah, so like Tales of Graces F remaster, which came out earlier this year, that was my first time playing that with Zillia. I just pronounce it like that wrong every time. With that game, I believe I briefly played it on PS3, but I wouldn't count that as any experience with it. So I got access to the Steam version before launch. What happened is, I don't think they sent out many review codes or like I didn't see any other coverage for it. So I had access to the Steam version like very close to launch, and I just decided to like figure out what I could do with it. So I found some technical issues with it, which I'm kind of surprised they shipped with, because the game. So like just brief like reminding people of how it is on. This is a Switch 1 game, not a Switch 2 game. And it's released on PS5, not PS4, and Xbox Series and PC. So the game is capped at 60 on like PS5 and Series. On Switch, it's 30. And on Steam, they said it supports up to 120. But this 120 actually is not as good as it should be. So what happens is, I don't know if you played Neo 2 or Neo 1. I believe one of them had this issue where if you set it to 120 and your PC can't hit that, the game runs in slow motion. That's what happens with Tales of Zillia Remastered. Like if you play it on Steam Deck with a 90 hertz display and you set it to 120, your game is running in slow motion. So I realized this after 2 minutes of playing. I was like, why does this remaster feel so sluggish? Like Graces felt so snappy and everything was quick. And then I realized that the game logic or game speed is tied to the frame rate. So you have to cap it at 60 if you play it on a PC that can't hit 120. So that was the first annoying thing. But they did put an effort with the port where it does scale nicely above the PS3 version. They have changed some lighting, some reflections and stuff. But again, like I have not played the original. So I was approaching this just from like what I could see on the screen and what I could play. So like I think... I don't know if we have a review going up or not in the near future, but I think Paul has played the original, so he will know how to approach that better. But yeah, so the Steam version was like literally one day before launch or one day before whenever I could write about it. And then I was told no Switch review codes. So that was a problem for me, because with Tales, I get the most requests from like readers and friends saying, like, can you let us know if the Switch version is fine to buy? Like, because, you know, Symphonia is basically like, it's how dog shit that port was. It's kind of like spooked everyone, and understandably so. So what happened with this is like, I said, fine, I'll play it on PS5. I just picked it up on Switch on the eShop, because thankfully it's a budget release. So it wasn't like a complete waste. But yeah, like it's unfortunately not great on Switch.
Sure. Did you play with Japanese voices or English voices?
English.
Because I heard there's a bug with the Japanese voice where the skit won't play due to some frame rate issue or something.
What I do is, if I'm reviewing a game, I will try out both language options for a few hours or at least an hour, and then I'll take a call. But because I was just doing a technical thing here, I was just like, I just put it on English, and I did find the English voice levels were a bit off here and there with some characters, but I don't know, like I did not have time to go deeper into the game. So
I have two comments. Sure. One, I heard that there were just kind of like a multitude of skit issues, maybe on related to like various things. I saw Cullen mention something that like he got a skit that like appeared like hours after it would have been like relevant, and it's like, I'm not sure why this is appearing now. And like some skits just not appearing as they should, and he was playing with English voices. I don't think it's just purely a Japanese voice thing. Speaking of voices though, I remember this from the PS3 version, you know, 10 years ago, the voice actress for Mila, not necessarily her voice like performance, but her voice like recording quality for some reason was just like noticeably worse than every other character in the game. So it's like distracting whenever she talks, and it's just like, was your microphone not set up quite right or something like that? And there seems to be like evidence to suggest that, because this problem doesn't exist in the second game for her. So that's still there as far as I know. Just like that character's voice quality just sounds worse for some goofy reason in English.
Yeah, that's there in the remaster as well. In fact, that's one of the things I noticed it. First, I thought it was like, you know, in Persona 5 Strikers, the English dub, you can tell it was recorded like during the pandemic and they had to like do home studio and stuff because the voice levels go all over the place in the dub. But over here, yeah, like her voice is very noticeable. Like it's something feels off. So yeah, it's... I probably will try out the Japanese version, but I'm going to wait for patches at this point. But so that's the thing, right? I don't know about the skit stuff because when I was playing it, I was just playing it normally. Some skits appeared. I thought, okay, this is how the game is. And I just continued like playing it and like retesting it and stuff. And then I finished writing. Like, basically, I do not recommend buying this on Switch if you have access to any other platform, literally. And yeah, that was my takeaway from it. And I was like, okay, time to revisit this like after a few months when they patch stuff. Oh yeah, the other thing is because this is a remaster with DLC included, they ship the Grade Shop, which is like the new game plus thing in Tails games, where you can enable like 5x XP, double damage and like critical rate and like a lot of... And access to like just free like in-game currency and stuff. So they have that, and they also have a lot of the original game DLC, but not all of it. So not the licensed stuff didn't make it back in again, even though I think some of it is owned by Bandai Namco. I forgot the exact IP which they didn't include, but there are two or three costume sets which are not included, but everything else is included. So yeah, it's I don't know if this is how they're going to approach the second game also, and like what they do over there with that, but I hope that when that comes out, it's in a better state, because especially for people who've played the original are finding random issues with either like reflections or other visual issues also. So yeah, we'll see how that
goes. Yeah, it seems like based on what we talked about here and also kind of skimming on some of the feedback from people who've played this on Steam, it feels like don't even buy this at all yet until it gets some critical patches, especially like, you know, even missing content like the inconsistent skits and how that's being sorted out, but even like bugs relating to the frame rate, as we discussed here, which could break some items in the game. It just seems like it is acceptable for some people. For some people, it's running okay, but for people who like remember the original and like expect it to run like the original game, this is bordering like unacceptable for a number of issues. So I'm like, okay, this game doesn't exist until they fix it up, because this is unacceptable at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that covers both all of the games we've been playing and then a few of the games that we've been able to talk about through some of the headlines that we have, like the interview up for Dragon Quest 1 and 2, and then some of Mikhail's kind of performance features for Tales of Xillia across Steam Deck, PC, and the different consoles. So with that, we will head into news. Is this where we wave goodbye, Josh?
Yeah, both Mikhail and I have to go for different reasons, personal obligations, but just happened to be coincidental that we're leaving at the same time.
No worries, we'll hold down the fort. Adam will steer me straight through the news here.
Yeah, I believe in you guys. Good luck, and we'll
good night.
Meet up next. Mikhail and I will return next week for big Inazuma talk.
With both of us with new iPhones, except mine is for my mom.
What did you say, James? I didn't catch what you said.
And perhaps other stuff too.
Mm-hmm, perhaps other stuff too. Correct. All right. See you guys later.
All right. And actually, we're probably more than halfway through. I mean, I should definitely say that at the 2-hour mark. But there's not a lot of news this week in terms of announcements. In the end of the year, there really tends not to be. Though we are starting to roll into media releases for that quarter one 2026 release. So a lot of these games have announced release dates in January, February, and March. So we're starting to see some trailers and updates for those games. But before we get into that, we do have two kind of studio related just news posts here that we at least wanted to touch on in terms of how they affect our coverage at RPG Site. Leading off with news out of Square Enix this week, and there's been a lot of headlines here across from multiple outlets with this. I'm sure if you're listening to this podcast, you've probably already seen the headlines. Square Enix is still working through a bunch of major restructuring, specifically looking at their Western studios and their Western heads in US and Europe. And then as part of this restructuring, the main headline that they've said is that they aim to utilize AI to reduce the workforce of their QA department by 70% is the headline title number that we keep seeing. So obviously we've seen a lot of kind of Square Enix posture changes over the last couple of years in terms of like their release strategy across different platforms, what they have kind of agreed to with like the Final Fantasy VII Remake series and what the platform exclusivity has bought and kind of detracted from in terms of that release, in terms of like many of their remasters and smaller projects that they've kind of mercenaried out to other studios, exclusively releasing those on different platforms and not having them all be same date, same time. So this seems like this is kind of tied into that sort of trying to get their feet back under them, so to speak. Adam, just checking with me, did I miss any context about the announcements of these like QA reduction goals
for the next year? So where this is coming from is a lot of Japanese publishers have their like yearly financials, right? So like they do a report every quarter, blah, 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 year over year. But a lot of Japanese publishers also do what they call medium term plans. Medium term is a 3-year period for most publishers. And starting in this year, Square Enix's medium term plan, this is the one where they called it Square Enix Reboots and Awakens, if you remember that phrasing. And they just put out basically an update. They call it literally a progress report for their medium term plan. And they're basically like, yep, this is how our new multi-platform strategy is going. And they even have like a little like spreadsheet about like, here are the games that we've released with all the platforms they're on. Here are some games that we released in prior fiscal years, like Final Fantasy VII Remake, coming to Switch 2, coming to Xbox, talking about, you know, we're taking games and that were on certain platforms and putting them on the other platforms, all that stuff. But included in this update were those two things. One, there's a slide in their update called Promoting AI Utilization in Japan, and they quite literally say, just in plain text, their goal is to automate 70% of QA and debugging by the end of 2027, which is the end of the medium-term plan. So that's where it comes from, is they literally just say, hey, this is part of the plan, this automation of QA and debugging. And then there's another slide that is titled Overseas Structural Reform, Reorganization of Overseas Organizations. And they say, you know, it's a lot of like business speak, but they need to like consolidate their publishing efforts in their overseas markets and blah, 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 blah. But of course that means layoffs. And there was, separate from this report, there was a call, like a business phone call from Square Enix Japan to their overseas publishers, talking about, you know, the specifics that they're going to do in terms of these restructuring. And I think Bloomberg got like, you know, secondhand reports about like what was discussed in these calls and whatnot. And those layoffs have already started to take place. There's some people have already announced that, you know, their positions are affected or whatnot. So this is immediate.
On my LinkedIn, I've been seeing just a bunch of people from Square Enix making posts about how they've been part of the round of layoffs. It's not great. And what's also not great is the timing of this, where it's like, it's not directly related, I don't think, but the timing where they also announce their intention to replace a bunch of QA with AI, like, you can't announce those both at the same time and not realize how bad that looks, right?
Yeah, and it's one of those things that it may not be like, they may not be perfectly directly related to say, like, it's probably too simple to say, oh, the people are being laid off because they're being replaced by AI. It's probably not that simple. But I will say, literally in this update, it goes from one slide to the next. There's the promoting AI utilization slide, and the very next slide is the organizational reform slide. So they're like right next to each other. Yeah. And
neither here nor there. It's like, I don't doubt like some elements of QA can be automated using AI to like help augment it. But I mean, obviously, I don't think in any way, shape, or form they're going to be able to replace 70% of their like quality assurance with AI. That is not going to work out that way.
Yeah, they have a couple of, you know, infographics in these slides. You know, sometimes these IR infographics are always a little bit silly. But like, for example, they have like these four boxes for like overseas publishing where they have like they have these headlines or groups: regional marketing, creative, communications, and brand marketing. And then they're like, we're going to consolidate that all into regional marketing function development. And it's just like, okay. So my point is they have like these kind of segmented groups with, you know, various purposes, and they're going to try to kind of like trim those and kind of group them and clump them together to try to be more efficient. And that's what, you know, that's how they're trying to, you know, show that in a public, you know, IR document. But it's how well is it actually going to work, like in practice? You know, I'm not hopeful.
And obviously, us being a Western, you know, English facing website, when they say they're cutting roles in their, you know, Western European studios, those are like people we work with. So this isn't us just looking at headlines or looking at, you know, layoff numbers. This is people that we've emailed and worked with and messaged and collaborated
I've
with.
I've been to like Square Enix's North American LA offices, like something like a dozen times at this point. I've met a bunch of people at Square. So it's, yeah, there's some people that have been impacted. I have absolutely met in person.
Yep.
Not great.
And the other studio that we're going to be talking about, this is another giant in a similar but different news post here. This is coming out of Amazon Games, who has obviously struggled to, I guess, breach the gaming market, like mind space, ever since they really like stood up Amazon Game Studios, because we saw the struggles with, you know, their original plan to publish Blue Protocol, which ended up not working out. A few other projects. Was it Crucible? No, it wasn't Crucible. Was it Crucible? They're like Crucible. Hero shooter. Yeah. It got unreleased.
Yeah, the game that was in beta, then released, then retroactively put back into beta, and then canceled.
Yeah, and the reason why I bring those up is because I tee up their one thing that could seemingly be called a success is that they did launch New World, the Amazon Studios MMO that released in 2021. Then they brought it to consoles like a year and a half ago with Aeternum. And even though it didn't set the world on fire, it had a steady player base. It had like, I think like 30,000 concurrent on Steam. Like basically it was an MMO that got past like that first 2 year, you know, bathtub curve, where it didn't fall off, found a loyal player base, was getting regular updates, got its console port. It was the one place where it's like, well, okay, they found their footing here. But they've announced that they are ending content updates for New World Aeternum, and they've only committed to keeping the servers up through 2026. They've stated that that's their intention, but basically they do not know how long New World will stay online, but they've pledged that they will share the news as soon as possible. But basically New World now has an expiration. We don't know when the expiration is, but it is going to shut down. So this, I think, there's a lot you could read into this, and it's a lot of it is speculation, but to me, this is a very big kind of retreat is how I read this, because the one thing where you had solid footing and some success, they are backing away from. And I don't know like what to read into that. I know a lot of people smarter than me have already kind of chimed in.
I saw some headlines. Basically, it seems as if Amazon is going to start going more into like, quote, casual or like party or like those sorts of games versus, you know, MMOs, like, I don't know, social games. Like that, it seems like that's the new tack they're trying to take is, you know, these games are probably cheaper, maybe a broad audience, something like that. It feels like they're stretching to like more of these like MMO type, because they had like three or four, maybe even more different MMO type games that they're looking into. Maybe that just didn't seem to be didn't seem to be working out for them, large picture.
And I mean, like, I don't mean to be mean, but you gotta question the planning that went into a lot of that when one of their whole games they were developing was Lord of the Rings. And it's like, when people ask, why are people gonna play this Lord of the Rings MMO instead of the already existing Lord of the Rings MMO that people like? And they just said, oh, people just move over. That never happens with MMOs unless you have a good reason for it. Like, people are unhappy with the current state of the existing one. There's a new gameplay loop that's interesting, but it's like Lord of the Rings Online's been going on for almost 2 decades. And you think that people are just going to hop over to a new one that's going to have like almost no content at launch? No, that's not how that works.
And as far as I can tell with the Lord of the Rings MMO, like, we have not, it's all but, it's, correct me if I'm wrong, because it's a volatile situation. It's all but confirmed that the new Lord of the revamped Lord of the Rings MMO from Amazon is canceled, because Amazon themselves haven't come out and said it, but former employees have. So it's like, as far as we can tell, their plan to move to a Lord of the Rings MMO is on ice. And like you said, James, like, I remember when they were the tact, I've never played Lord of the Rings Online, but I forget the exact statement, but they're like, yeah, our goal is to bring people to the new game. And it's just like, they're not just going to dump their old one. And I don't want to just repeat what you said, but it felt like a tone deaf statement where it almost reads to me like their goal is just to breach into the market space, and whether or not they actually like have like real care about their IP, like they want to leverage their IP for sure. But they're just like, and a Lord of the Rings MMO makes sense, and that's a revenue generator. Let's get that off the ground. And there was also things floating around about, like, from former, you know, directors about their goals with Amazon Luna and like their Twitch gaming like initiatives, how they were planning to compete with Steam. And it was like, I couldn't even tell you were planning to complete your planning to compete with Steam, because your tact was so different, because it was, you know, free games through Prime Gaming or game like little cosmetics, and then the Luna streaming thing, which was very much in the realm of Stadia, which didn't succeed. Yeah.
It does sound like, at least on that front, they finally realized what they should have done all along, where it's like, you own Twitch, tie whatever gaming efforts you have into Twitch, make that the marketing push, because there's like millions of people that watch Twitch and are highly engaged with gaming every day. I don't know why that wasn't the original plan. Crazy.
Yeah. Look, and they don't know anything about games.
Like, I am not a game executive. I'm not even a game employee. I'm just a guy with a microphone. So maybe if you blew this off as like, you know what I'm talking about, that's honestly fair. But like, the one thing that Steam doesn't really do well is like their live the Steam sharing capabilities in terms of like streaming or capturing. They only recently this year added like video capture directly through Steam. Like the storefront aspect and like the Steam Cloud, Steam Server, that's going to be an uphill battle for anyone trying to compete. But the one place that you could potentially wedge is like the social aspect of like that Twitch has. So that's like one thing that they could leverage. But then the way that they tackled it, like, they bought some tiny storefront, which I don't even remember what the name was, like, that didn't make a splash. And then like all of their initiatives to like get people to Luna, I think a lot of people just are kind of they're not going to step their foot into that streaming area. Like, the population potential there is limited. So the fact that they said that they're going to compete with Steam, it's just like, it felt like it was something supposed to be complementary to Steam, not competing for it and with the goal of ostensibly like replacing it or supplementing it. So that was all, it all seemed a bit like misguided. And according to this former director, it was just like, we just thought that if we put enough resources, budget into it, that it would be inevitable. And it wasn't, apparently. And yeah, Adam just linked up a post here, a Verge headline from late October. Amazon is ditching MMOs and cranking out party games. The author here is Jay Peters. So yeah, covering all of the evidence about the memo from, let's see, I'm trying to figure out the last name is Boom. Steve Boom, Vice President of Audio, Twitch, and Games, kind of detailing the pivot from big, giant, inevitable MMOs to smaller party casual titles, which is like that could be a valid strategy, but it's a big swing and there are, you know, almost casualties in the way regarding the studios at New World and whoever was working on Lord of the Rings. So it's all unfortunate. But yeah.
This is not directly related to Amazon, but it's partially related. I actually just earlier today published Paul's kind of impressions piece on Blue Protocol Star Residence. The reason why this is Amazon related in a way is that Blue Protocol, developed by Bandai Namco, the original version was going to be another Amazon published MMORPG in the West. And I know a handful of people were looking, or maybe more than a handful, were really looking forward to that. However, the game released in Japan, struggled in Japan by all accounts, and never did get a Western release, so it was just canceled altogether. So how did that affect Amazon? Who knows? But kind of weirdly enough, like a different publisher took off, like it was going to be like a Blue Protocol spin-off game, and kind of that game sort of rebooted into Blue Protocol Star Resonance, which is now available, just released last month, as like a free-to-play gacha-filled MMORPG. And Paul checked it out, and he wrote up like kind of an unscored review of it. And his takeaway was basically kind of like, yeah, this is kind of a pleasant, repetitive, you know, kind of boring MMORPG that really wants you to link your PayPal account. And also leaves no lasting impression. So it's kind of like, he found it kind of like monotonous, but kind of pleasant in a monotonous way, but also kind of like, yeah, this game really wants you to spend money. And that's just how it is. So he put up his thoughts.
Which is honestly probably what Amazon wanted with it. I mean, that's what every publisher wants, right? It's just how much you actually put something meaningful behind that goal.
Yeah, the way he phrased it was just the way he phrased it was like the faintest of praise, where he's like, yeah, when I'm waiting for my laundry to finish, I can go ahead and boot this up on my phone and waste time with it. It's good for that.
Oof. Yeah, that's a backhanded compliment of ever. Yeah. So, yeah, apparently Blue Protocol Star Resonance, not leaving a lasting impression, but it looks like Paul was able to leave some good things for the kind of a, we can kind of bring this back to an article shadow on RPGsite.net. So, yeah. Obviously, we'll keep tabs on whatever Amazon continues to work on. And of course, for Square Enix, we're eager to hear any details about the final part of the remake trilogy, whether it's going to be multi-platform, PC at launch, or who knows what. But that's kind of like the next big thing we're waiting on from them. Because they also did like their sales. Wasn't there like final publishing of their sales results for the last year also just made public in the last week?
The second quarter. Short version is that their sales are down, like the amount they're selling. I think that's primarily due to actually Kingdom Hearts on Steam last year, that they couldn't compete with that this year so far. But their actual like income is up, so costs are down. So like they're selling less but making more.
Obviously, we're kind of between major releases from them outside of that Kingdom Hearts PC release. So it's kind of one of those things where it's expected to look at to see that when you're looking year to year.
Yeah. And like, for example, Final Fantasy Tactics came out at the very, very end of the quarter. So it like contributed some, but like September 20, whenever it was, so like a very small amount.
And next year, it's like, well, obviously Dragon Quest 1 and 2 HD2D will be part of that, but question is how well is that going to do compared to 3 HD2D? So who knows?
So here in this last section of the podcast, we'll go into other news. Not a lot, but a few big headlines. I do have some articles here that were put up by, I think one was from Mikhail and one was from Kite. These are two Japanese games that got announcements for 2026 releases in the West. So one of these is from NIS America, developed by Gem Drops. They're the ones that did Star Ocean, right?
Yeah.
They have announced Etrange Overlord, which is releasing on PlayStation 4 and 5, Switch, and PC in the West in 2026. It's already got a release date in Japan for March 26th, and then likely a later date, middle of the year, in the West. So NIS America announced that they're going to be releasing that for English-speaking regions for, again, a Trange Overlord.
So this one, I actually do want to say one other thing about this, because
okay,
there's some backstory to this that makes it really fascinating. So this is being, like, the director on this is Sohei Nikawa. Did you know that A Trange Overlord, or however you pronounce it, is based off of another, like, an existing property?
Nope, like, I don't recognize it.
I don't know if it's a manga or if it's a light novel. I think it's a manga. And so after, it's a manga. After Nikawa left NIS in Japan, A Trange Overlord started, and I forget the exact name of the person who did it, but with the announcement of this game with Nikawa at the helm, he revealed that actually that was just him using a pen name, and that manga has been under him the entire time. So that's actually pretty fun. It's like, oh, this is like an adaptation of an existing property, but it's like, it's Nikawa's property, so it doesn't really matter.
But he just did it under like a pen name. Okay,
yeah.
That's kind of fun. And then the other game, this is a little bit different, but also slated for a 2026 release. This is an article that Kite put up. The game is titled Alchemia Rogue, Mia and the Mysterious Labyrinth. The publisher and developer is Lime Leaf Games, which is like a Japanese indie developer. As far as I can tell, this is their major debut project. And they are stating that they're planning to release this in 2026 for PC, both Steam and Epic Game Store. And they are also stating the game's going to be available in Japanese, English, and Chinese. So as far as I can tell, they have not partnered with a publisher. Like, I only have Kite's summary, including the announcement details and trailer. But like, an indie Japanese studio releasing their debut project worldwide with Japanese and English, that's just kind of like a combination of details that you don't normally see. It's a roguelike game where it looks like the protagonist is able to transmute items and use alchemy to unlock recipes to progress further in like the game's dungeons. So I'm kind of interpreting that as like a mix between like Atelier and Moonlighter, so to speak, only without the shop aspect. So the trailer is only like a quick minute long, but just kind of a cool little indie project to keep an eye out on for PC release next year.
It's also really funny looking at the screenshots and then looking at screenshots of Sheeran the Wanderer 6 and being like, hold up.
I wonder what inspired this.
Yep.
A couple other trailers for some games or expansions to games releasing in the back part of 2025. This one felt like it was early. Like, I wasn't expecting this so soon, but an expansion to Daemon X Machina Titanic Scion is releasing on November 14th, Into the Abyss. And we got a trailer from Marvelous, showcasing the new expansion. So I don't know if people like Josh or others who have played... Wait, James, did you play Titanic Scion or no?
I did not. I have not had the chance to yet.
Yeah, so I'm not sure. I'm not sure if Josh is on board with it, because Josh, I don't want to speak for him not being here, but he didn't seem to really take to the base game too much. I don't know how much interest he has in the expansion, but it'd be cool to see if anyone on staff is interested in playing this. But, you know, November is a busy time of the month, and it's releasing in under a week, and got a little trailer showcasing it, but we don't really know like how much it actually adds. There is the demo still available for Daemon X Machina, which carries the save data over, so for those that haven't picked it up yet, there is still that, and then the expansion will come out in just a week. Inazuma 11 Victory Road, it's got a bunch of its final trailers. I guess we'll kind of table that for next week, because I know Josh is going to go hard on that. Also a November release, the Atelier Ryza. I was gonna say remasters, the deluxe pack updates re-release, slated to come out as a trilogy on November 13th. Gus has just released basically more trailers showcasing some of the new playable characters in the earlier Ryza 1 and 2. And then Ryza 2, and like Ryza 1 has new characters, Ryza 2 has a new map. Rise of One also has an additional story. So these are just little quick trailers showcasing some of the new content in each game. Going into, one more for release of this year. I almost forgot about this one. The remaster for Sacred 2 Fallen Angel, which is launching on November 11th. We got a fun little behind the scenes like dev diary for it, including some of the like original developers behind the game. So John Stradall, who's one of the original creators of the franchise, talking about re-releasing the game on modern consoles. So I'm not a big, up to date on the Sacred series, but it's just kind of cool to see a creator be able to revisit something that they worked on, 20 years ago and re-release it to modern audiences. And then we're starting to get into the media blitz for the upcoming Code Vein 2, which is launching at the end of January. We kind of had like the story trailer that talked about how it involves time travel and finding heroes from, I remember I brought this up, like the long gone age of 100 years ago. I'm like, 100 years is not that long. But and now we've got a trailer for Lou Magmel, one of the main kind of like heroines of the game. It doesn't state that this is like the beginning of a series of character trailers, but I would not be surprised if that's what this is. As they, basically we've got, 2.5 months until the release. So I wouldn't be surprised if we start to see character trailers drop in every other week or so. First one, Lou Magmel, heroine of the game.
Yeah, these games have that like buddy or partner system. And it seems like she's basically the first buddy. So like the most important one. But I'm assuming they'll follow this trailer up with kind of the rest of the buddies that you can have.
Couple other quick updates. We are recording this the day after N7 Day. N7 is not as big of a celebration as it once was. Of course, a day based on the N7, branding from Mass Effect. And then BioWare themselves have used the day to give updates to the series. Of course, in the wake of all of the news involving publisher Electronic Arts, the status of BioWare has been a lingering question for a while now, and the questions have only gotten louder recently. Mike Gamble, who is executive producer of Mass Effect, took this year's N7 Day basically to say that the team is still heads down and focused exclusively on the new Mass Effect title. We are still working on it. So basically, this year's N7 was reassurance that Mass Effect 5, or whatever you want to call it, is still happening as of this moment.
I have two comments.
Which is good to see. It's just like, yeah, go ahead.
This is the cynical way to look at it, but it does make me think of like, my Mass Effect is not canceled shirt is answering questions already said by my shirt or whatever. that they have to say that it's like they're still working on it. But two, I saw some chatter like they might have like hidden some stuff in the message that might clue you in on what the game might be about and when it's set and whatnot. Personally, when I get to those sorts of like teasers, I kind of just ignore it and be like, all right, someone else figure this out and give me the summary later versus like diving into the teases and whatnot, but there might have been more to it in terms of like what they were saying about the game. I don't know. I didn't look into it.
Yeah, I completely would have missed that if that was on there. I haven't. I'll go to the Mass Effect Reddit. I'm sure they've got it all kind of distilled at this point. But that does seem like something that I'm not against that in a post that's otherwise kind of not somber, but kind of just like very transactional. Yes, we're still working on it. Bear with us. Putting in something for the fan base to speculate over. I have no issues with that. We have a release date for the upcoming announced expansion to Pokemon ZA. So the Mega Dimension DLC will launch on December 10th. So I'm still making my way through the base game of ZA. But the Mega, what's it called again? Mega Dimension will include new Mega Evolutions like Vax Caliber and Chimecho. Chimecho.
Is this the one with the Raichu?
I think so.
Is this one with Mega Raichu?
Mega Raichu Y and Mega Raichu X, which might genuinely be my least favorite Mega Pokemon designs in the entire series. I'm sorry, Ken. I know you love them, but I'm sorry. Ken, it's Ken Shepard.
Yeah, Kotaku.
Kotaku.
He's a big Raichu fan.
I'm looking at the images here. So I haven't completed ZA, and I never played XY. So I see like Mega Emboar or whatever his name is, and Mega Feraligatr. I'm like, are these new? I don't know, but they're
yes,
sick.
They are.
Some of them are more sick than others. Mega Meganium. Mega Meganium just looks like a bunch of cuddle pillows kind of stacked on top of each other with all of her like neck pedals. So that's fun. I need to get back to ZA. I'm about halfway through it. And then we kind of got a trailer and for another upcoming early release next year, Yakuza 3 Kiwami, and then it's like attached little spinoff, Dark Ties. They have started, or sorry, they've released a kind of a behind the scenes video with the voice actor, I think with the voice actor. Yeah, with Kuroda and a few others. So talking about, you know, voicing new lines for the series and things like that. I do feel obligated to bring up just as part of the Kiwami 3 release is that RGG Studios is no stranger to recasting certain characters. Like one of which was like one of the protagonists from Yakuza 4 ended up getting his in the HD remaster of that game, getting his likeness completely replaced. Due to like a scandal that he was in. And for Yakuza 3, we kind of run into that again, where one of the characters, Hamazaki Go, who is portrayed by Teruyuki Kagawa, is returning despite Kagawa admitting that he sexually assaulted two women in 2019. And RGG Studios, for whatever reason, I don't think they've had a statement other than that they've recast him. So there is, I've seen people on social media saying like, hey, you know, why... It's just like an inconsistent footing. How come you're not recasting this guy who has, you know, admitted to this? So I've seen that on social media. Figured I should at least kind of give it a call out. To my knowledge, RGG Studios has not acknowledged that in any sense. And obviously the game is already slated to release, you know, early next year. But one thing that RGG Studios, I think, could have communicated better, and they haven't really given good rationale for how come in some cases they will recast and in other cases they won't?
I mean, in this one, they're just like deleting pretty much as when they can any commentary about it, which is not a great look.
So. Yeah. So. A few other just quick little dates. I believe Obsidian teased this like way back in March, but Pillars of Eternity, the original game, is getting a public beta for its turn-based mode, and that'll be available on November 5th. So Pillars of Eternity famously, well, I shouldn't say famously, it was a real time with pause, which is like very classic Baldur's Gate 1 and 2. However, a lot more games have been leaning into having turn-based options. Like Owlcat's more recent games have been entirely turn-based. Pillars of Eternity 2 ends up adding turn-based. Pillars of Eternity 1, up until this point, was entirely real-time with pause. But we'll get a turn-based beta, I say November 5th, as of this week. A couple other release dates. Just for some indie titles. So, Kingdom of the Night, which is an 80s-inspired action RPG from Dangan Entertainment. Dangan Entertainment is releasing on December 2nd. And then the last bit, we have kind of an announcement of a very specific port, Almanage Original, which is a dungeon crawling blobber, you know, RPG from 2011, is going to get a Nintendo Switch port in April 2026 from, I believe it's from Ghostlight. I'm trying to think. There's a lot of publishers listed here.
Yeah, sorry. The Almanage series is kind of a very niche dungeon crawling series that's been, you know, different versions have been coming to different platforms, all ported by different publishing. So when you look at our database, it gets a little bit confusing. I've been meaning to play Almanage Original for probably more than 10 years now. I think it originally released for like 3DS and PSP. And I think Ghostlight was involved with that. And then it eventually came to PC, to Steam. And now it's coming to Switch. I played Almanage Gothic, which was a really, really hard dungeon crawler, like one of the hardest dungeon crawlers I've ever played. Apparently, Original is much more like standard, like a normal dungeon crawler, which is probably still fairly hard. Yeah. But
I think the hardest dungeon crawler I've played was probably Stranger of Sword City.
Yeah, Gothic is more insane than that. Gothic, it's very, very insane. I've been meaning to play Elden Ring Original for a while, and like it came to PC like in 2016 or something like that. Maybe not that early, but like years and years ago. I'm like, oh, I'll finally play it, and I still haven't.
Yeah. I love how one of the Switch screenshots is just everyone died.
Yep. And that's kind of it. So I know just a couple headlines as we kind of wrap up the end of the year. As we kind of discussed, next week we'll definitely be going into, finally, after like a decade and a couple like relaunches, Inazuma 11 Victory Road. I know Josh is going to go into heavy detail on that because we've been looking forward to that one for a while. And level 5, like it's interesting talking about level 5 multiple times in a single year on this podcast because it hasn't been the case for a long while now. Probably a few other surprises. And then going into December, start thinking about end of the year things. So I know we're all trying to wrap up. Like I mentioned, I'm working on Pokemon. Other people are trying to finish up Dragon Quest, a few other things, because in December it doesn't slow down because we got Octopath Zero on the horizon. So as a reminder, just programming note for anyone who follows, in terms of like the RPG site year, we go from December to November. So we will still cover December releases as they release. But in terms of end of the year stuff, we're looking at kind of that end of November cutoff. It's just we had to draw the line somewhere. That's where we drew it. So that's where we're at. So next week, we'll be talking about that. Go ahead and give the reviews from James for Hyrule Warriors Age of Imprisonment a read, as well as Mikhail's features about performance of that game on Switch 2. We've also got that Dragon Quest interview and a few of the Tales of Xilla features, as well as that Blue Protocol kind of opinion piece all up on the site at rpgsite.net. You can find RPG Site on all the social media platforms. Just search for RPG Space Site. You should be able to find us. Join our Discord, discord.gg/RPGSite. If you've listened to this TetraCast, go on whatever your podcast service of choice is. Leave us a like, leave us a rating. We'd love to see those. And we'll see you next week to talk about Inazuma 11 and maybe a few surprises. So until you hear from us next time, stay safe, take care. We'll talk to y'all later.
Later, everyone.